Chichicha Castle?
Katiche.
Katiche Castle? How do you say it in Slovak?
Katiche. I don't know. We're stupid Americans. You preserve the social hierarchy.
I'm educated in American public school. This is a movie about a woman who killed people. See, there's the difference. There's when you talk to me and there's when you talk into the microphone.
This is going to be the longest Miss Noig episode ever.
The Horror. A punk, femme, queer, and real sophisticated approach to horror films. For more information, visit thehorror.net.
Oh, I should have some coffee before I started doing this.
Yeah, don't sound so excited to be on the day, Jill.
You know, alcohol kind of kills my enthusiasm for podcasting sometimes.
Go away. I don't care that you know about aliens. I'm hungover right now.
Softlight's great. The host is great.
Yep, sure it is. Sure it is.
Softlight's great. We proved our point on that episode.
Hey, we convinced Joe and Chris both to kind
you
of shake
stay out of this.
He's about to kill Krycek when Scully intervenes and shoots Mulder in the shoulder, allowing Krycek to escape.
And then he's like, "Bitch, you shot me."
The whole thing was like, if you kill Krycek, we can't prove you shot your father. Well, if you let him go, then you can't really prove that. Yeah.
This is actually the first episode I ever saw, which meant that I didn't like it when I first saw it because I didn't understand what was going on.
I think the X-Files as a whole is just awful, and we should stop.
You're fired.
The Explodey Files, brought to you by DeadLantern.com.
Ready? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode... Oh, crap, I do this every time. Oh, my God, look at what episode it is.
Stay in.
Okay, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 28 of the Zombie Girls podcast. With me tonight, as my fabulous co-hosts, are Miss Sarah.
Hi.
And Miss Matilda.
Hello.
Unfortunately, Ariel and Jody are both struck down with illness of various whatever. So tonight, we're going to be talking a little bit about... a certain franchise you may have heard of called the Scream franchise, as well as our usual non sequiturs and nonsense. So, to kick things off, I want to ask what you guys have been watching. Sarah, you want to go first?
Sure. Honestly, I haven't really had a whole lot of time to watch anything. Been bogged down with other projects. I took a class on digital writing and somehow have ended up having to do like 4 different video projects.
Wow.
So, yeah. Wow. So, yeah. So I have been extremely busy working other stuff, but I did happen to get a chance to read a novel by rock star Greg Kinn, who he wrote a novel called Horror Show, and it he wrote it in like 96 or 97, something like that. It takes place in 1996 and flashes back to 1956. And it's about a curse of this movie from 56 called Cadaver. And it's about this guy who works for like a Fangoria type magazine that goes to visit this infamous director who's like one part Robert Corman, one part John Waters.
Hmm.
And talk about this film Cadaver because there's a rumor that they used real corpses in it, and then talk about this, you know, supposed curse. And it's like, what happens? It's about what happens from there. It's the telling of like the making of Cadaver and the things that surrounded it. Like there's a
is this
a
fiction or nonfiction?
This is nonfiction.
Oh, it is
nonfiction.
I'm sorry.
This is fiction.
Oh, okay. I was like, Holy shit. Are you serious? Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a quick and easy read, and you can kind of guess what's going to happen at the end. But it was still a lot of fun.
Awesome. I'm always looking for a good book.
I feel like I have to check that out. Yeah,
I spend so much time listening to or reading stuff that is like underwhelming. I read that book Breed recently, which was like quote unquote the best horror film horror book of 2012.
Yeah, that had so much hype from.
It was not that good.
Really?
No.
Another one I read recently, which I'm probably going to get some flack for this, because I didn't really enjoy it, was Down the Road by Bowie Abara, who some people may know in the derby world as Chip Queso. But it's a zombie book. It's about a guy trying to make his way home, and there's like this subplot that involves like his fiance was doing work for a drug dealer and ends up dying. But it's like my major thing with it is that subplot, because it's like this guy doesn't know the details of how his fiance got killed, and yet like the book's kind of climactic scene is him confronting this drug dealer over how his fiance got killed, and it's like, but he doesn't know this, so yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, I wasn't impressed.
Bummer. And it sucks when you don't like a book, too, because you've invested way more time.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Scream 3 has a runtime of, like, an hour and 45 minutes.
Or especially when you have, like, some connection that you want to like.
God, Scream 3 felt like Hannibal. Like, it just...
We're getting our spoiler alert.
I have already complained via text to Rachel this week.
Yes. I just started getting obscene cat photos. She's like, I'm entertaining myself while I try to get through this shit fest. Awesome. Okay. So any other movies or things that you've been checking out?
No, that's really it.
All right. Good times. How about you? What you been up to, Matilda?
Well, I saw Evil Dead with you.
Yes.
Which we can talk about.
We should talk about that a little bit, I think.
And I also, on your recommendation, finally read John Dies at the End and This Book is Full of Spiders, the David Bond stuff, which I really liked.
I love those books. I loved them. Have you read those, Sarah?
You know, I started reading John Dies, but it's one of those things, like, the semester started, I put it down, and it's been, like, 2 years.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah.
Well, if you ever have some spare time, you should definitely check it out again. I loved those books.
Uh-huh.
Loved them.
I liked the second one a little bit more.
Well, it's definitely more, like, properly structured, you know? Like, it's, like, it doesn't have all the weird, like, side stories, because it's because he actually sat down and wrote a novel as opposed to like
putting
a serial
together blog pieces.
Yeah,
and it's a little bit more my thing. Like, it's a little bit more conspiracy oriented and a little bit more
right.
kind of structural conspiracy, which I like. But no, I really liked them. The first one, I mean, I think I'm just learning this about myself as I sometimes do audiobooks now, because I did the first one as an audiobook and the second one as a paper.
Oh, really?
And I think for this level of surrealistic fiction, I need paper.
Oh, okay.
Because I kind of lose absurdity if I tune out at all.
Right.
And I don't want to miss, I didn't want to miss anything in the first one. So that may also be part of why I like the second one better, is I felt like I could pay a little bit closer attention with paperback.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, and you definitely, if you're missing the absurdity, there's really kind of no point with those books. Because that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think what else. I've also been watching Top of the Lake, which, have you started this
yet? Not yet, but I've been warned there's some dog murder?
There's some animal violence. Yeah,
no!
I just want to warn you that.
No animal violence.
Sarah, are you watching it at all? Do you know what it is?
No, I don't have cable, so if it's on cable or satellite or anything.
Yeah, it is. It's a Sundance miniseries that's 7 parts, and it's Jane Campion. So it's not horror, although it's pretty graphic, intense. So it's kind of Twin Peaks adjacent.
Okay.
Which is always a good comparison.
Yeah, and it's only 7. Like, it's kind of a slow starter, so I heard a lot of reviews that said early on you're going to be like, I don't know. But because it's only 7 episodes, it's an easy commitment.
Right.
It's set in New Zealand. And in the first episode, a 12-year-old girl from this in this tiny town walks into the lake. And there's kind of the mystery of, like, was she trying to kill herself? Was she not? And then they take her to the hospital, and she is quite pregnant.
Oh.
And then disappears. And Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men and also daughter of President Bartlett on the West Wing.
Oh, I adore her.
Yeah, me too. She plays an investigator from out of town who, like, I mean, there's a little plot hole in that the police basically hand this investigation over to her, which seems strange. But also in town, so she's a sex crimes investigator and very passionate about her job, so there's that. And Holly Hunter,
who I love,
is in this town running a, like, commune of kind of damaged women out of a shipping container.
Jesus.
I mean,
nothing says professional like a shipping container.
Yeah, I mean,
if you go to a doctor's office and it is located in a shipping container, turn the fuck around. That's all I'm going to say.
Is there a story about this?
No, okay, I'm just saying.
Good.
Actually, a couple of years ago, God, maybe about 10 years ago, there used to be a mobile MRI that traveled around the county my parents live in.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And it's actually like this shipping container where the MRI is.
Oh, no. Yeah. So creepy.
I would go to that. They're supposed to, when MRIs are expensive and you have to travel far. That's a good idea.
I guess an MRI, too. Well, the thing, that's a toss-up. Because on one hand, I don't feel like it's physically invasive. So somebody's not going to be like doing the door-to-door breast exam kind of situation. Have you heard about that?
I have not heard about that.
That actually did happen.
It did?
Yes. Some guy was like,
I'm going to guess it was a scam.
Yes, he was, you know, a traveling breastologist or whatever.
That is creative.
But at the same time, you get trapped in one of those, so that could be very troubling.
Well, that's why they have the open. So you're not in the tube. So if you're claustrophobic, have you ever had an MRI?
No, but I've seen them on TV.
I love them. I'm the person that likes to be confined. So
I know, I've taped you up. Which is not nearly as scandalous as it sounds.
No, I'm willing to bet it's either for, you know, something athletic or to try and get boobs into a dress.
It wasn't. It was,
I mean, it's kind of like trying to get in your boobs into a dress.
It's to make a dress form of your body. So you sacrifice a shirt, but Rachel wrapped me in two layers of duct tape for my birthday this year.
Happy birthday!
Because that's what I wanted, with my mother supervising. So, anyway, getting back to the top of the lake, so I recommend it. I'm four out of seven, and it's just kind of, you know, it's Twin Peaksy in that it's super odd small town characters,
which I love. That's
and like what
good,
the
good
interconnected
one.
Backstory is, and I'm kind of liking it a lot.
Awesome, cool. That's a little bit like how that new Bates Motel show is. Have you watched that, Sarah? It's very, like, small town, everybody has a secret, like, it looks so idyllic, but, like, under that, there's, like, sex trafficking going on, and sharecropping, mm-hmm. and just everybody's all mixed up in some sort of shenanigans, and it's, you know, it's Norman Bates,
mm-hmm.
so, on top of that, your like, quote-unquote hero is fucking nutballs, so...
Uh-huh.
So that might be a good thing if you're craving small town, check out that Bates Motel.
Yes,
hotel.
Although I mean
good.
I would give the trigger warning of like every kind of sexual assault kind
Ooh.
Of theme that so far it looks like it's really going to like the investigator's history stuff. So
okay, good to know.
Not to spoil it too much, but I'm in. It's pretty good, and Holly Hunter is so odd.
She's so
She
great.
Just sits in a rocking chair, like, being monosyllabic and smoking, going, no!
Also,
yeah. Yeah, it's pretty good. What else was I gonna say? Oh, and I finally finished one of my favorite thriller or mystery writers, who's like a Denise Mina, who's like a Scottish noir writer, who is, and I say this in the best possible way, really a sick lady. really a great writer and really a sick lady. There was one of her series of three books that she writes a lot about. Many of her protagonists are pretty profoundly struggling with mental illness stuff. And the Garnet Hill series is the most intense one of those. And I finally went back and it gave me, the first book gave me such nightmares.
Oh
the
my
first
gosh.
Time I tried to get through this series.
Oh my god.
That I had to go back. I mean, and it just, you know, it goes to, there's like human trafficking and the bludgeoning of old ladies and, you know, and people with skin conditions that their face is flaking off and oozing the whole, like, it's just.
See, I mean, I think there's something to be found there for horror fans. Yeah.
I never want to go to Glasgow after reading these books, although Rachel, you've said it's a lovely place.
I swear, Scotland is amazing. I so did not have that experience.
It just seems like where everyone gets drunk at 10 in the morning and has flashbacks.
Well, to be fair, I was getting drunk at 10 in the morning, so maybe I was just fitting in. I don't know.
But I finished them, and they are wonderful, and I also just got her new book and finished that.
Oh.
Which is great, which is, oh God, I'm not going to remember the name. It's the Alex Morrow series.
Okay.
But yeah, any of her books, I think, are really, really fantastic.
I think we're going to need to do, like, a books episode at some point where we swap book suggestions.
I don't mean to, like, pull the nerdiness.
Pull the nerdiness? Have you heard the show?
But over into books in a different way. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So those are my recommendations.
Excellent. Those are good recommendations. Okay, so I guess I'll, unless you have any.
That's it.
So we should talk a little bit about Evil Dead. I mean, I don't want to go too deep into spoilers. Although, did you listen to the whole Splattercast where we talk about it?
Yes.
I can't remember how much we spoiled it. I'm sure we spoiled some of it.
Oh, you talked about pretty much all of it.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I
listened to it too.
Okay.
I gotta say, I fully agree. If I go into a basement and it's filled with dead cats, I'm getting the hell out of there.
Seriously. Like,
but you don't, like, say all the Satan words out loud. Right? Especially when you open it, it's like, fuck this book, close this book, get away from this book.
Right, you don't pull out a pencil and, like, lightly scratch across it so you can get the word that has been black. Yeah. Remember, that's how he got it.
Yeah.
It wasn't even visible. He, like, sought it out. So, I mean, I definitely feel like the further away I get from the movie, the more I like it.
I feel the same way, yeah.
You too? Mm-hmm. Like, I think I was just sort of gobsmacked when we walked out, and I was just like, I don't know how to feel about this movie.
I was a little overstimulated.
Right, right.
By all the gore.
Yeah. By the end, I think we were just, like, having fits of giggles by the end, because it was like, can't take anymore, too much.
Well, we were also in a fantastically teenager yes, heavy theater.
We had a good crowd.
And so the giggles are kind of contagious in a whole teenager heavy crowd. But I really, the farther away I got from it, the more I really liked the device of using addiction and possession.
Yeah.
Next to each other, which is new in this movie.
Yeah. Yes.
That Mia is ignorable. And that this
they
is kind of the cover.
They dismiss anything that she has to say automatically, and that is the caring thing to do, the way that the logic is set up in this, that it's, you know, a loving thing to ignore someone who is...
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they've all teamed up to help her by ignoring her distress. It's
well, and also the way that, like, addiction gets talked about in more traditional ways right now, that it's... that you are not yourself because you're, quote, in your disease. So the disease is running you, as opposed to that it is an almost possession-like way like in the medicalization of addiction.
Right.
That we talk about that. So I thought that was really fascinating.
Me too. Mm-hmm. The guys on the show did not like it. And I actually thought that gave her a lot more pathos, like, as opposed to just sort of the real cookie cutter people who are, and I love the original Evil Dead series, but I mean, they're not really great. Aside from Ash, they're not really great characters. So in order, when she ultimately kind of becomes that final person, there needed to be some meat on that character. Mm-hmm. And I thought it did a good job of making her interesting. And like you and I talked a little bit about off the show, about how it made her a much more complex final girl, a much darker and more damaged final girl than you normally see in in sort of the tropes of the genre. So I thought that was great. And
who actually comes away with damage.
Right.
Which is rare.
Right.
As opposed to just, you know,
Sydney's, like, light
dark hair and a flinch. She has, you know, or whatever final girls come away with. Usually, like, we assume
she's straight up maimed at the end of that thing. Ugh. Mm. And I have to say, as someone who kind of thinks of myself as being a little bit of a lightweight when it comes to gore, I felt like, yeah, I did it. Mm-hmm. you know, everyone I know who was said that was, like, the... Obviously, they've seen more hardcore shit than that. But as far as, like, in a theater, it's the most hardcore they've seen in a long time. And then I got through it, I was like, maybe I'm not as big a fucking wimp as I thought.
Well, were a lot of them practical effects, too, yes. Do you think? Which I really liked.
Yeah, definitely. It's much better than the CGI.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, like, a couple little moments, like, where the chick's arm, like, falls off, I think, is CGI. And
the electric knife.
Yeah. From the electric... Don't make me get out an electric knife. I have one.
I can't believe you have an electric
totally.
Knife.
Totally. Come over on Thanksgiving. It comes out. Although, now I'm giving it side eye whenever it comes out.
No, I really liked it, and I liked that so many of the attackers, because of the kind of, like, roving possession
yeah.
thing, like, so many of the attackers were female and kind of, and this is maybe where the Diablo Cody influence is there,
uh-huh.
and, like, seem to kind of have this gendered quality to their attacks, and then sometimes not. Like, right. it didn't do one or the other on that, which I kind of liked it.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I have not heard a ton of podcasts talk about it, but I'm wondering, because she's so, like, in somewhat, for some reason, she's so, like, reviled by horror fans, that everything they don't, what I've noticed is that everything they don't like about the movie, they put on Diablo Cody, and everything else is on Faye, and I'm like, all she did was, like, work a little bit on the dialogue. Back the fuck up. She did not direct the film.
Okay, can I talk about Sam Raimi, though, a little bit? Because I saw okay. that.
Uh-oh.
I saw
you totally
that,
just got serious face,
everyone.
I saw everyone.
That Piece of Shit Oz movie. Did anybody
oh,
else
no,
see
I didn't see it yet, because...
Oh, Oz? Yeah. No, not yet.
Oh, I...
Let it all go.
Can I let it fly?
Let it fucking yes. fly. So,
strong start. First uh-huh. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I'm like, okay, I'm in. And it goes from, like, black and white to, like, beautiful Burton-y color when they get to Oz and all this right. kind of, like, just amazing visual effects. And then it just all goes to hell. To the point that I kept turning to Mr. Steinem in the theater and going, like, it is your fault that we are here. You made me do this. And he's like, I know, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
What, this can is you my give fault. Me an example of a moment that made you turn to Mr. Steinem in disgust or frustration or whatever you were feeling in that moment?
I can't even begin.
Wow.
James Franco is at his least appealing James Franco.
What happened there?
I don't know.
I mean, he'll, like, Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks is gone.
It is, because, like, is... I feel like that gives him a lot of, like,
I know.
Room
I, that gives
to maneuver
him a long...
into douchehood before you can
yeah.
write him off.
The gender politics of this movie are worse than, like, a 1940s Sleeping Beauty era Disney.
Really?
1940s era Disney. Oh,
yikes.
The brunettes are all terrible. Michelle Williams, who I love, has nothing to do except...
be pretty.
Look adoringly at cad jackass James Franco.
Oh, you know? No!
There are lots of bad... I mean, it is just... And Mila Kunis, who I also like,
love.
Is
yeah.
awful.
Really?
I mean, because I think she doesn't have anything to do except
right.
be scorned and therefore turn evil.
Right. Because that's what you do when you don't get the love, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of losing my shit because the gender politics were so terrible, but
yeah.
then it was also just awful.
Okay.
is the other
so
piece.
I don't feel bad about missing that one.
No, and Sam Raimi...
he needs to stick to horror.
It was kind of unforgivable. It was really bad.
Wow!
And I know that they were restricted, right, because Disney...
Right.
So who is it? MGM then owns... the original Wizard of Oz story, so they cannot reference. And was it Disney's?
Well,
a different
they,
company was
it's,
making it.
It's, no, it's the movie that they own, but there's so many things that they that they're so strict on the copyrights for that.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, yeah, they have a real hard time making anything else because if you even like reference one little thing that you know, you basically violate the copyright.
Right, that's what I was trying to say.
Gotcha.
Inarticulately. But so I know they were restricted, but oh boy.
Really? Well, so Robert Downey Jr. was originally supposed to be the main character. Would he have saved it in any way for you?
He
think?
Probably would have helped.
Because he actually has a little, like.
But I would have also felt badly for him that he had to do that.
You can see why he dropped out.
I was just kind of like, no girl under 12 should see this. This is bullshit.
Wow.
Yeah. No, like the lessons that this teaches about.
So you had like the Twilight response.
which I didn't even have that hard to Twilight.
Really?
Yeah.
I had that it harder than enraged I did at Twilight. Me.
Really?
Absolutely enraged me, those fucking terrible.
I mean, I can see why they're.
They're horrific. They're like normalizing abuse in relationships.
Yes.
And like.
Watch you sleep.
Right!
Yeah, it's true. Like, the appropriate response is to call the police.
Right! Has her kidnapped to keep her away from her friends. Like, that kind of stuff.
Right. So. But I find that to be kind of, like, more paternalistic and bizarre.
Yeah.
And the abstinence porn quality of Twilight was part of what got under my skin so hard mm-hmm. about.
First time you have sex, get pregnant, and have your pelvis crushed.
Which, whatever, like, I'm not mad at kinky people, but, you know, I do think that the glorification of her abstinence and his, like, kind of paternalistic gentlemanliness made me crazy in that series, but, oh, the Oz stuff is so bad.
I'm, like, curious to see it now just to see how bad it is.
It's like if you could make Fatal Attraction into a, like, kind of the overall message of Fatal Attraction into a child-appropriate movie.
Oh, Jesus. All right. So, up with Hayao Cody and down with Sam Raimi. You heard it here. Wow. That's really disappointing to hear.
I mean, to the point that the blondes are good and the brunettes yeah, I mean, are bad, like, kind of.
When was the last time you saw that? In, like, Teen Wolf? Like, aren't we done with, like, like the good, or I guess that's
Vinny
the
and Veronica?
Teen Wolf. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. So, anyways.
So that's my Sam Raimi hate fest.
If you want to see a really funny Mila Kunis interview, go to YouTube and look up Glove and Boots.
Oh, and, okay.
Yeah, she gets interviewed by this puppet Mario, and it is hilarious.
Real? I've Ooh. Seen the yeah. one where she's getting interviewed by the British guy who's like keeps asking her out.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that
this
one?
Kind of this is a little bit of a takeoff on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That was pretty funny. Like, he clearly was in over his head. He had no fucking idea what he was doing. And I can, as a journalist, I can definitely, sympathize with that moment. Although I haven't ever actually asked anybody out. But I've definitely geeked out. All right, so I guess at the end, what I would say is that I ultimately really liked Evil Dead.
I did too.
More, I came out of it not liking it, and then as I've, like, thought about it and processed and was like, okay, how do I feel about the gender politics in this movie? Because it is such a, like, integral part of the movie, I think, in a way that it's not in other Evil Deads, that I was like, yeah, no, I'm on board. I liked it. And, yeah, I really like the girl who played Mia. I thought she was awesome. I'll never look at that show Suburgatory the same way. It's a little, like, now when I'm watching her, I'm like, ooh.
I think that because my movie, I mean, I've seen the Evil Dead movies a long time ago, and my movie memory is so short.
Right.
So short. So it was like a whole new standalone to me. So I had no, like, I'm so mad that this shit, I had none of that.
Yeah.
But I really liked it. I liked the effects. It was one of the first movies in my life that I've watched through my fingers.
Yeah, me too. Well, I mean, That's not true. Not half of that. I definitely watched it through my fingers. I've watched other things through my
There's
fingers.
There's like a tongue thing that I was...
Oh, that's yeah. the worst one. I think... Oh, it's, I can't decide if that or the ripping off of the hand is the worst. It's kind of... Oh, they're mm-hmm. both so bad.
But it kind of has that like cringe and wonderful thing at yeah. the same time where like... Where there's a little slapstick, right? There's like the banana peel in the bathroom, and there's.
I did like the take on the banana peel slipping moment.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess I've been going on about Evil Dead too long.
I liked it.
Oh, disclaimer: 3 hours of sleep, so I'm having a little trouble today. But I'm drinking my coffee. It will get better. All right, so that's basically what we've been watching. Are you guys ready to go on to the main event?
Sure.
How about you, Sarah? Yep, you ready to rock? Okay, so since you suggested this topic, I'd like you to go ahead and maybe lead the discussion a little bit. Are you up for that?
I can see about it.
Scream 1.
Scream 1.
The movie that changed horror of the 90s.
Sure.
It kind of did, no?
Yeah, it kind of did.
They should have just named it Jump Scare, though.
It actually was originally titled Scary Movie. That was supposed to be the name.
Oh.
So, okay. Scream, the original Scream, released in 1996, in December of 96, and directed by Wes Craven, written by Kevin Williamson, and...
of Dawson's Creek fame.
And Aaron Kruger, starring David Arquette, Nev Campbell, Courtney Cox, Randy L. Jackson, oh, I'm sorry, Roger L. Jackson, Jamie Kennedy, Liev Schreiber, Matthew Illiard, and Skeet Ulrich. Oh, and Rose McGowan.
And Skeet Ulrich's bottle of moose.
That's most of what I have to say about this movie.
The hair in this movie is pretty incredible.
And then, of course, Drew Barrymore.
Of course.
So, so Scream starts out. You kind of jump right into it with Drew Barrymore as Casey Becker making popcorn and getting ready to watch a movie when the phone rings. And her and the caller go back and forth. You know, he calls her a couple of times, says, oh, sorry, you got the wrong number. Next time he calls back, he's like, hey, just wanted to apologize for that. Then he actually calls back again, starts talking to her. And once they start talking, conversation starts on movies, and then it goes from movies to, he says, you know, I want to know your name. She says, why? He says, because I want to know who I'm looking at. And that's when it takes the pivotal turn, and it starts to get malicious.
Hey,
the conversation starts to get malicious. And it just, it, I don't know, you guys want to take it from here?
Sure, okay, so basically what happens is, we get our first call from Ghostface, and we get a great sort of hunt and, like, stalk and kill scene where he chases her through the house. There's a lot of, like, am I inside the house? Am I outside the house? And ultimately, I have to say, because this has been parodied so many times, I wasn't taking it that seriously, and I forgot how straight-faced this first kill is done. And it's pretty tragic because she ends up getting chased and stabbed, and she's in within earshot of her parents, but he's just choked her, and so she can't call out to them, and she gets killed like 10 feet away from her parents. She like almost makes it and ends up hung from a tree with her guts spilling out. So that, and it's like Scream. So that was, and like I said, it's been parodied so many times that...
Yeah, we were actually talking about the parody and we couldn't remember which, if it was Shriek, if you know what I did last Saturday the 14th, or if it was the Scary Movies where he stabs the girl in the chest and the implant gets stuck to the knife.
It's a Scary Movie because it's Carmen Electra.
Okay.
The implant comes out.
I remember the sprinkler
sounds
scene.
Sounds very Wayans.
It does sound. It has the stench of Wayans on it.
Yeah.
So, okay. Let's just do sort of like a... I'm going to do a really short synopsis for this because I'm not going to go deep on any of these. That sounds... why do I keep saying go deep? I do that all the on the other podcast too. Okay. Anyway.
that was my cousin's best man speech at his brother's wedding.
Go deep?
Yeah, he says, I have two words of advice for you. Go deep.
Wow. I'm sure the mother of the bride really appreciated
that. Wow.
Okay, so where we go from here is now it's in a high school setting, and we get our main cast. There is Sydney Prescott, who is who's also has sort of like a tragic past. A year prior to the movie, her mother was raped and murdered, and her boyfriend is Skeet Ulrich, and she's got some friends, including the very obnoxious Matthew Lillard and Jamie Kennedy as the movie expert. So obviously it's a small town. News breaks out that there's been a murder, and it's the talk of the town. We also meet Dewey, who is Rose McGowan's brother, who is the sort of Barney Fife-esque deputy in town.
Mm-hmm.
And we're introduced to Gail Weathers, played by Courtney Cox. Can I just tell you, when we get to the fourth movie, it is like someone is wearing a Courtney Cox mask, and watching them in a row like that and seeing the pre and post plastic surgery was Shocking. Yeah. Not to be catty, but I just had to throw it out there. So she is sort of like your ball-busting career woman, and she's like repeatedly villainized for her ambition, but she has written the book on Cotton Weir, who is the man that Sidney Prescott accused of raping and murdering her mother and sent to prison for life. But she thinks he's an innocent man. So there's already sort of like an adversarial kind of relationship between Sidney and Courtney Cox, who immediately starts flirting up the deputy to try to get in and get the story. So then there is Jamie Kennedy, who is also their friend, and he is sort of the movie nerd of the group, who is the one who is like, who explains the rules of horror movies, which becomes a trope throughout the series, where you have the movie expert dropping knowledge bombs at one point posthumously in a very obnoxious scene, but we'll get to that when we get to Scream 3. So the rest of the film, basically what we have is we have a killer who is hunting and stalking Sydney. She's fighting him off effectively. Other people are not so lucky, including Rose McGowan, who gets death by garage door. And it all culminates at a party at Matthew Lillard's house, where after the news breaks out that somebody else has been murdered across town. I can't remember who it is at this point because they're all blending. The party breaks up, and all you have left are Sidney Prescott, who is ready to take her PG-13 relationship all the way to X, and with her boyfriend Skeet Ulrich, and Matthew Lillard's, whose house it is, Randy, who's drunk and watching Halloween, and then Gail and her cameraman, who is the guy that plucked out the other dude's eye in Deadwood.
I was going to say the guy from Deadwood.
Yeah. As well as the deputy Dewey. And we get the final chase scene. We get the reveal that all along there's actually been two killers, which is why they've been able to kind of be in two places at one time. She had suspected her boyfriend, but she had gotten a call from Ghostface at the same time he was in prison, which exonerated him, but it was because there were two of them working together, and it was the boyfriend and Matthew Lillard, and they had the whole, you find out the motive for it is, first they say there's no motive, that's the new motive, is to have no motive, but then you find out what actually happened is that Sidney Prescott's mother had had an affair with her boyfriend's father and ruined that family, the mom abandoned them, and so they framed Cotton Weir, killed her mother, and now they're going to kill her and get away with it by stabbing each other, which is a great plan because you should definitely do that before you kill everybody to weaken yourself before.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, so there's
feeling a little woozy.
My mom and dad are going to be so mad. That's actually my favorite line of the movie.
Get me the phone, Dick.
So Sydney does her final girl act here, and she is able to kill, I think she kills both of them.
Yeah.
I can't remember how Matthew Lillard gets it. Oh, yes, I do. She drops the TV on his head, which, it's playing a horror, it's playing Halloween, so he is literally killed by a horror movie.
Uh-huh.
And then she, like, shoots the boyfriend and becomes, like, you know, sort of an iconic final girl. Rescues her dad, who was taped up in the closet, who they were going to blame the murder on. Dewey survives, although apparently originally he was supposed to die, but in test screenings, people liked him so much that they added the thing of him being on the stretcher.
Oh.
Yeah. Gail Weathers makes it through, even though her poor cameraman from Deadwood does not.
I love him.
It's worth saying that this first movie is kind of bloodless. There's a lot of stabbing, but in terms of the violence, it definitely ratchets up as the series goes on.
I mean,
that one's pretty good.
The Drew Barrymore and that stuff, like, that's pretty.
Yeah.
Bloody.
Right.
But yeah, other than that, but there's lots of, all of these movies have such close kills, like, it's so, like, made me think so much, like, knives are really personal, like, it's everybody, they're just... right up and
yeah
everybody's stuff. Yeah.
Yep. That is accurate.
Matilda's thoughts on screen. They're up and the knife is up in everybody's stuff.
So, okay, what do you guys want to say about this movie?
I still really enjoy this movie. Although I do find myself, because of another podcast I was listening to talk about this movie, now whenever I watch it, I play the Billy Stu game. Was that Billy on the phone or was that Stu? Which one?
Oh, yeah, right.
Because you have that, especially because you have that scene where they're talking about, you know, Casey's death, and they're sitting there having their lunch, and you see that look on Billy's face when Stu's like, oh, I didn't kill anybody, and he's kind of grits his teeth and looks at him and says, and nobody said you did. And so it's like, okay, with Casey, I think he was the one screwing around on the phone and Billy killed her, and then, you know, it goes back and forth. I don't know.
I wonder, you know, if I hadn't thought about it, I wonder if that would have added some level of enjoyment to the movie. You know what I mean? To sit there and try to figure out who did what.
Mm-hmm.
So now this is the first time you ever saw any of these movies.
It
Matilda.
Is.
So
I was a total scream virgin. So All at Once was maybe a little too much.
It's a lot of scream.
I was like, I don't yet have nostalgia for this, and I know you're trying to bring me back, but that was yesterday, so maybe switch it up.
So, but of the first one specifically, what did you think?
Really liked it.
Okay.
I really liked it. Yeah, good twist. Like, I don't know. I just thought it was good. And the kills were good.
Mm-hmm.
So
did you know anything about the twist going into it? Like,
no.
You didn't know it was the Mm-mm. boyfriend?
No. And I think that because I had never seen any Scream movies and I've never seen any scary movies,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't, like, the mask is associated with parody to some degree.
Right.
For me.
Right.
So to go back and be like, oh, this is the actual scary part of these. Yeah. No, yeah. I really liked it. I thought it was great.
Awesome.
I was distracted by the hair.
The hair is distracting. Everything, the styles and the hair. Like, actually, I got to give Brandy credit for this because we laughed so much at the clothes early on. When we got to the fourth one, he's like, we're gonna go look back at this in 10 years and laugh so much at the clothes when we're wearing our silver speed suits. You are a fool.
Well, I know Skeet Ulrich from Jericho,
right,
where his hair is somehow cleaner.
Yeah. Post-apocalyptic hair.
It's the post-apocalyptic,
and he has the like 90s like twin tendrils in his face that I'm so glad
isn't,
that look
isn't
is
that
gone.
What Jody refers to as the 90s curtains?
Is that what that is?
Oh.
They're the worst. And I remember, oh my god, I remember thinking he was such a fox when I saw this in the theater. Brianne was so in love with Skeet Ulrich.
Really?
Oh yes, he was so dreamy. I mean, he's horrible. Because I saw this in the 90s, like in the theater, and at the time, like, you know, horror was really in a lull. Like, there was nothing good. And this movie felt so, like, fresh and, like you know, amazing, like, return to horror kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, it did not really hold up for me.
The first one?
Yeah. And I don't know if it's because, like, I've seen it's so, like, redone so many times since then that it doesn't feel fresh anymore. Or I found it a little too, like, it was, like, a little too self-aware for me. There was a little too, like, this reminds me of a Wes Craven movie. I'll be right back. Like, it was too much.
Yeah.
Like, it felt really heavy-handed.
Uh-huh. And that gets worse.
Right. Definitely. But it was maybe because it was, like, the original one, for some reason, yeah, it just did not really work for me that well. Which was kind of a bummer because I remember loving it and I was just kind of like, this is faded. This is a little tarnished by time for me.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Although I did like the Wes Craven cameo. Did you catch that?
No. I was just reading on IMDb that I also missed a Linda Blair cameo.
Yeah, that's right. There is a Linda Blair. She's one of the reporters.
She's the first reporter that walks up. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Wes Craven is the janitor in the Freddy Krueger outfit. Named Fred, which I actually thought was pretty funny. I was like, okay. I think that it happened super fast. And I was like, I think that's Wes Craven. I had also forgotten, though, that Henry Winkler was in this movie.
And he was fantastic.
Yeah. He was actually
He was great. I love Henry Winkler.
Me too.
Apparently that scene was all improvised. Like, they you know, he told him he was supposed to just chide these kids with the mask, and so he decides to grab the scissors, start cutting the mask, and he's flinging them, that whole scene where he's just flinging them in the kid's face and just going on about how, you know, sick and disgusting and depraved your generation is.
I thought
that was like one of the best parts of the movie.
And I loved him on the intercom. He's like, your principal loves you. You need to go home and be on by curfew. Like, I love that character. Did you catch in the fourth movie that there's like a really terrible bust of him in the hall?
No.
Yeah, it's sort of in the foreground, and it totally looks like a bust from the Hello video.
That's so awesome. I know. Is anybody caressing it?
Unfortunately, there was no. He was not the one he was looking for in that. But he was. It's just in the foreground, and I thought it was a nice touch. But yeah, I would say Henry Winkler was a nice, like, revisiting surprise. But the rest of the movie was a little schwing wing wing for me. So yeah, okay, so that's Scream 1. Any other thoughts, ladies?
Well, originally, Drew Barrymore was cast to be Sydney, and, David Arquette was cast to be Billy.
Ooh, that's terrible.
Can you imagine that?
Just like, no.
No, when you're talking about Courtney Love and the plastic surgery.
Yes.
Did you see the Scream documentaries?
No.
I think I mentioned this the last podcast. Rose McGowan and the surgery. Like, ooh. She has to talk like this now because she can't move her mouth.
It's pretty sad. Because
she's got this weird, like, over-collagen duck mouth and just the cheekbones. I mean, it's like, oh, what the hell happened to you?
Like, Hollywood.
Yeah.
That's what happened. Because, yeah, they're all looking rough. There's something that happens, like, post-40 to, like, and it's sad to female celebrities now. They have to get all the crap in their face.
Mm-hmm. I know, and we were talking about this, that people are doing it in their 20s and 30s and stuff, that they're just, like, putting all the fillers and all the...
Yeah. Bad times. This is a good cautionary tale for that. Oh, okay, so here's another bit of trivia. This has suddenly become the IMDb podcast. Sorry. But, okay, the part at the beginning where Drew Barrymore is, like, crying and scared.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty convincing, right? Well, the reason, or what Wes Craven did to get that performance is he's actually on the phone with her, and he was telling her animal cruelty stories.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, that would do it for me, but that's why, like, she's looking, like, disgusted and crying. He's telling her horrible animal cruelty stories.
Oh,
I mean, it's really good direction. He got a great performance out of her, but how traumatic for her! I'm like, oh!
Well, apparently they had I want to say it was during the scene where Ghostface is chasing Sydney in the house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the initial one. Mm-hmm. She goes to call 911, and since they were using a real phone, they had the guy that did the voice, like, in another building, and he was calling him in, right? On his cues, watching on a monitor and calling him in. Well, for some reason, they had a junction box to prevent any outside calls, just line to line.
Yeah.
The box shorted.
Oh,
so when
no.
she dials 911, she actually called 911. So I guess during that scene, like, the cops raided the warehouse that they were filming in. They heard all this screaming.
Oh, that's hilarious. Wow. Oh, that's funny.
And I think Rose McGowan is the first one to refer to the killer as Ghostface.
Oh, really?
Because she says in the garage something about, like, you know, okay, Ghostface, you know, get out of my way or something like that. She tries to go back up the steps. That's when he takes her arm and he cuts it.
Right. Huh. Well, good mm-hmm. for Rose McGowan. Mm-hmm. So, what do we think of Sydney as a last girl? Good, bad, indifferent.
I always liked her.
I like her too, and I like her. I like the piece, which we can talk about in the subsequent movies, where when she's not sure how to who to trust, she'll make a hard call.
Right.
Often mistakenly, but she'll make a hard call. I do like that
mm-hmm.
about her.
I love the, in all four of the movies, there's like a moment where the badassness kicks in. Mm-hmm, and that's mm-hmm. always my favorite part, where she flips the switch, you know, and she mm-hmm. goes from being the victim to the survivor girl. And I think I actually think Sydney's a pretty good one. I will say that one thing I came away from this is actually still really liking Sydney as a character. I thought she was, I mean, like, I didn't really care for the whole, like, stuff with her being, like, virginal and, like, you know, all the really cheeky ratings and they're really, you know, like, as far as PG-13, uh-huh. R-rated, like, that kind of stuff, that dialogue. I was like, woof.
Yeah, no. And
that's
why.
That's right.
And you know what? Kevin Williamson, he's a genius. Diablo Cody, she's shit.
Yeah.
I'm like, go back and watch Scream 1 and let's have this conversation again, please. Okay. Thank you. But yeah, I really thought Sydney was great. And I think she actually gets better as they go on. And especially...
She gets a little... God, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of sociopathic in a way, though. Because it's like, okay, she shoots Billy at the end, but when she walks up to the killer in the second one and just grabs a gun and bam, right through the head. I mean, it's like, I just hands it back, like, here you go, and walks off.
See, I read just that like, as her being like, you know, been here, done that, fuck that. Like, just sort of, not sociopathic
It is a little bit of a sociopathic attitude. A little bit. I'm not saying, like, she's a full-on sociopath.
Did you hear that, everyone? Sarah said she's a full-on sociopath. Get her! Burn her! Just kidding. Don't do that.
I think she just reads as, like, such trauma kitty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the form that, like, her fight or flight kicks in so fast that she's like, let me just take care of this.
Not in my movie.
Yeah.
All right, so are we ready to move on to Scream 2? I am.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this one's 1997. As with all of these, directed by Wes Craven, written by Kevin Williamson and somebody named Krueger. So in this one we establish the things that are going to be the repeating tropes. We have the pre-credits kill this time with Jada Pinkett and Omar Epps. They're at the premiere of Stab, which is the movie based on the book, based on Sidney Prescott's story in the first movie. There's a little logic problems when we get to the fourth one we'll talk about with this. But anyway, in this one, Jada Pinkett, or her boyfriend goes to the bathroom, or they go to get food or whatever. The boyfriend gets killed in the bathroom. She gets killed actually in the theater by Ghostface because everybody's all dressed up. See the evils of cosplay? She gets stabbed. She stumbles on in front of the screen, and that's when everybody realizes, like, oh shit, she's not just screaming at the movie. She's being murdered. And it just so happens to be on the day before the anniversary of the Westboro murders. And now Sydney, we go to find Sydney. She's away at college. Her and Randy have gone to the same college. And it's totally like, it made me think of like Saved by the Bell college years, where they found a way to like get the principal over to the college. I mean, like, they've had to like figure out how to get everybody over to the same college. But now we've got Sydney's got a roommate and her boyfriend Jerry O'Connell, and not a big Jerry O'Connell fan.
All I can think about is the singing scene. Sorry.
The singing scene? Oh, I'd already blocked it out.
Actually, you know what? We started doing the parody from Not Another Teen Movie. Mm-hmm. Sing a song with her name in it. Then we all burst into Janie's Got a Gun.
So, okay. Her boyfriend, who's just like wackadoo in love with her, and because of the murders, Gail is on the scene, ready to get the story, because she literally wrote the book on it. And with her, though, is Cotton Weary, who has now been exonerated because the death of Billy Loomis proved that he was an innocent man. He was only guilty of sleeping with the mom, not the raping and the murdering. So, but the problem is now Ghostface is back and he starts picking people off. Much bloodier this time around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a this is the first time we really get the heavy, like, whodunit kind of vibe where everyone is suspicious. Like, everybody's, like, side-eyeing all the time. And
it's also the first one where we get the issue of the day, which is, does media cause violence?
It's, yeah, that's right. And this is where they...
Movies make psychos more creative.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So we've got Randy still in the house, and he's, like, giving the new rules. But this time, it's the rules for the sequel. We also have Portia de Rossi, very right. young and very thickly eyebrowed, as yes. a sorority girl.
It's 97.
It is 97. What are you going to do? So, and because...
Rebecca Gayhart.
And Rebecca yeah. Gayhart. I think she was, like, a line.
Yeah.
And okay, so and Dewey's on the scene because he wanted to check on Sydney after the you know after the murders start, which I think everybody forgets that like his sister was murdered in the first one. There's like never any reference to that ever right. again.
There's actually no there is like one line dropped when they're all sitting around when Gail and Randy and Dewey are sitting there before Randy gets killed. She says something Butter. About, you know, and your sister. And then in three, I think Dr. McDreamy makes a reference to his sister, too. Like, but it's just like one little line, and he just kind of winces, and then they move on.
Yeah. I don't know. I always feel like, I mean, I understand Dewey's a popular character, so they bring him back, and they don't want him, like, freaking out over his sister. But don't you think he should have a little more... like trauma from having had his sister killed by a garage door. I mean, it's pretty gruesome the yeah, way that she is. Ends up, but it's just kind of a throwaway sort of thing. Okay.
Right. So, and the only person he feels responsible for is Sydney. Like he doesn't, there's no, like he's somehow not a, like she's the only one that shows trauma.
Right.
Is that part of what you mean? That he yeah. somehow is just like,
he just remains sort of Barney like Fife-y. The Barney Fife kind of comedic romantic kind of character because
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of like will they won't they Gail and Dewey action here. One of the best things I would say about these movies though is sort of the like 90s teen actor rogues gallery that shows up in yeah. them. Like I mean like I don't even think Pacey killer. Has a line, but he's in the
Who?
Pacey, you know, from
no he's he says he's got like one or two lines, but yeah, Joshua Jackson. And
yes. From Dawson's Creek and Friends.
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
I mean, there's like a ton of people that show up. Like I just started like writing a list as they were showing up. Timothy Oliphant is in this movie before he got his bad, like his, he has the really, I love him. I love him in Justified, but he has the worst veneers. They're enormous. He has to talk around them and they're very upsetting. I think he's had them filed down a little bit, but
the Hillary Swank.
Yeah. They're even worse. They're like, it looks like he's having trouble getting his lips around them in, like, Hitman and some of his movies. But anyways, and it also has, like, well, I don't know the actress's name, but Jackie from Roseanne.
Totally, it's Jackie from Roseanne.
Laurie Metcalf.
Her name is Jackie from Roseanne.
Yeah, and Laurie Metcalf turns in a very exciting bug-eyed performance
yes.
as the
yes.
as the new reporter who is sort of the foil for Gail Weathers. So, where was I going with this? Okay, so yeah, the killer shows up. They start picking people off. Buffy gets killed because she stayed behind while everybody else is at the sorority party. We also get sort of the in-joke of Tori Spelling playing Sidney Prescott in the movie Stab, which is a joke from the first movie.
And Luke Wilson.
Yes, Luke Wilson. That was right. See what I mean? The 90s cast in this is kind of spectacular.
Yeah.
Even though the movie itself is maybe not that great, all the like people that show up in it are pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So we get the singing scene where, because Sydney's having trouble trusting her boyfriend, as you would imagine, but he wants to prove his love. So... like any girl would ever want, he bursts into song in the cafeteria and then gives her his necklace, his frat necklace, which by the way, nice touch, in the third movie she's still wearing it.
Oh
yeah.
Oh.
So this is another case where we've got the killer who is everywhere. And you're like, okay, how is this killer everywhere? There's also a lot, I think the quality of the kills go up in this. We get some really gory deaths, including a pipe through someone's head.
And he's still moving.
Ugh. Mm-hmm. So, okay, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So, basically what happens is people are getting picked off and they decide that they need to take, including Randy, which was the most upsetting of all the kills in this movie. Because even though it's horrible Jamie Kennedy, I liked Randy. No? Am I alone in this?
Okay, here's my thing about the second movie. Alright. I didn't mind the sideburns and the little goatee, but seriously, could they not get a prop person to like do something with his ears? Because I don't remember his ears looking all like elfish when in the first one, and it kept bugging me. I kept looking at him and thinking he looked like a leprechaun.
Aww, poor Jamie Kennedy.
Oh. I didn't notice. I know him from Malibu's Most Wanted, and so which really taints kind of everything it.
It touches.
Once you're thinking about that,
yeah,
you can't, you know.
Straight out of Malibu.
Have you seen it?
No, but I've seen, I used to watch the Jamie Kennedy Experience, or whatever, and that's where that character came from originally.
Oh, okay.
So I've seen the character. I know who you're talking about. And it's hard to take Jamie Kennedy
seriously. It's a problem
seriously.
On every level.
Yeah. But at the time, like, you know, this was sort of like his star-making turn in these movies, so there was nothing.
Oh, okay.
But you can see the seeds of wackiness.
Yes.
In this performance. But I still was sad when he got, like, scooped into the van and killed to death.
Mm-hmm. The car kills were great, though. Like, the pipe and the...
Yeah. Well, so what happens is they take her... They're going to take her and her friend to a safe house. Because clearly this person is after her again. I think she gets attacked and gets away all badassly. And the problem is en route to the safe house... The car gets carjacked by Ghostface.
At a stoplight. That
yes.
Who kills the cops.
Kills the cops. One of them, I think he stabs. And the other one, who is like trying, he jumps on the hood to try to save them, gets, he crashes the car into like a thing full of pipes and the pipe goes through his head. Oh, it's so gnarly. I was like, okay, now we're talking.
Yeah.
And I actually really liked the scene because they're trapped in the back of the car. Cop car, they're able to pull down some of the cage between the front and back seat because they can't open the back seat doors. And they actually have to crawl across Ghostface. The only thing is I'm like, why is no one stabbing? Someone needs to stab Ghostface right now. There's a weapon in the car.
Mm-hmm.
So they successfully crawl across him and get out. But then, of course, Ghostface disappears and kills the friend.
But
so,
I love that it was all suspense. It's like the jump scare for the jump scare movies, it's the jump scare that never comes.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, and it's not until after they're out of the car, supposedly safe, that you get the jump scare. But yeah, that whole scene was pretty good where they're crawling across him. And she starts to almost pull off the mask, which is, of course, what everyone wants is for her to pull off that fucking mask. But he'll be unmasked soon enough. So this is one of the problems where there's a little bit of a logic fail. She runs back to the campus. Oh, wait, I'm skipping over another actually pretty good scene in this movie where Gail and Dewey are being chased by Ghostface. And they
the sound studio.
Yeah, they're like through the audio visual section of the college, and they get separated and on opposite sides of a like a soundproofing thing,
right?
Where she actually sees Ghostface come in and stab Dewey, what looks like to death, and you can see her watching it happen, but you can't hear her. I thought that was actually a pretty good scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good little chase scene where she's like ducking around corners and getting away from him.
Is that during the musical rehearsal, or is that later?
Oh, the musical rehearsal. First of all, that looks like the worst. I would hate if I had to go to that play. I would be so bummed if my friend was in that play and I had to go to that play and be like, that play was really great, because it was not okay.
Bad news for you, because I was like, I want to do that.
See, you would do a one musical number. I wouldn't have to sit through 2 hours of people in those stupid masks. Although that was a nice little chase scene where Ghostface was, like, amongst the berobed mask. You think that would be a trigger for her? Like, she would not be able to be in the play where everyone's wearing a robe and a mask.
Yeah, you think? And then you can see, like, the director figure it out, like, after everybody's,
yeah,
menacing her. And
okay, I have looked it up, and there's no proof of it, but I swear to God, Nathan Fillion is one of those masked guys.
I saw that. There's somebody in there that looks a lot like him. Yeah, I was like, I totally know exactly who you're talking about, because I had the same thought. I don't think it's him, but it looks a lot like him.
It looks like him, but like 20 pounds heavier than he is now.
Hmm.
Like, his face is like a little
more
square.
He was skinny when he was young, because he was on, like, One Life to Live. Why do I know that? Because I used to watch it when I was young. But
that scene reminded me of the end of Staying Alive, which was the...
Oh, yes!
The sequel to Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, I'm very...
Directed by Sylvester Stallone, music by Frank Stallone. Do you remember
that movie? I've seen that movie way more times than I've seen...
Yes! And costumes by Bob Mackie in the end. Did you know? Like all the
I didn't know that was Bob Mackie.
Dancing through S&M Hell is all costumes by Bob Mackie. Love that movie.
Love that movie. That is such a guilty pleasure. Oh my God. See, there's a perfect... Yeah.
So okay. I just wanted her to like shake her shoulders menacingly at all those people. Like put on a headband and shake her shoulders. Oh, and they'll all go away.
So, okay. So to get away, she runs into the theater. And this is where I'm saying there's a logic fail. Like, how did Ghostface, A, beat her there, and B, know that that's where she would go, as opposed to somewhere like, I don't know, campus security? Why would she run into... I mean, I realize she's a theater major, but if I was being chased, I would not be running to the journalism building. Or I'd be like, where's my faculty advisor? I'm being chased by a murderer!
Oh, it's not office hours!
Exactly. So absurd. But they need it to, you know, to have the big climactic scene, because they have it envisioned on the stage. It would make more sense...
Yeah, as soon as I saw that lifting prop with, like, somebody on it, I was like, there's gonna be a body on that.
And there sure is. Yes. So it turns out her boyfriend has been attached to this thing, and they were like, you know, the frat had taken him and they were torturing him, like, you know, by pouring cold beer down his pants or whatever fratty things guys do, for giving away his
pledge,
you know,
necklace.
And so,
signifier, whatever that, yeah.
So then in comes Ghostface. Are you ready for the big reveal? Turns out it's Timothy Olyphant. And he tricks, there's this moment where the boyfriend is tied up and Timothy Olyphant is basically indicting him as his partner, and so she stops untying him. And this is what you were talking about, making the hard decision where she doesn't mm-hmm. know what to do. And poor him. Turns out he's not a bad guy, he's just a frat guy, you know, like that's kind of,
he's just too one-dimensional,
right?
She's like, maybe you're flat and that's all been fake, but no, he's just flat.
So Timothy Olyphant ends up shooting him. And that's the end of Jerry O'Connell. Wah, wah, wah. Turns out he is just a wacky killer, and he is a theater, or he's a movie major, and he's going to, he actually wants to get caught, unlike Billy Loomis, and his defense is going to be that movies made him do it.
And the trial will be the true show.
I know, that's
so
what it all begins.
Timely, post-OJ. So timely.
And then
the mask don't fit. You must have quit.
Oh no! Oh no! Oh, Sarah, my love. So okay. Now double twist. Are you ready for the double twist? Turns out he also had a partner. It just wasn't the boyfriend. It was the reporter lady, Jackie from Roseanne, who, after losing 60 pounds and had a bunch of plastic surgery, turns out was Billy Loomis's mom. And she's just as crazy pants as her son. So she comes in, shoots Timothy Olyphant, and decides she's going to get justice by killing the killer of her son. And there's a little chase sequence where Sydney gets backstage and starts trying to kill her with
props,
basically. Right. She's like dropping the lights on her.
At some point, Courtney Cox goes in the orchestra pit. Does she fall in the
orchestra
pit?
Oh, yeah.
Pit?
She gets
shot and blown into the orchestra
That's
pit.
That's right.
Right. Sorry, I forgot about old
Using
Courtney Cox.
Using all parts of the theater.
See, this is why we need you on this episode. I didn't know what that was called. So,
I was killed by a scrim. The little cheer thing that comes between.
It's
like
called
a
what?
It's called a scrim.
Oh! We're getting technical up in this bitch. This is exciting. What's the thing called with the metal thing where it's like, wah, 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 wah? Makes the thunder noises. Oh, I don't
know. Thunder
maker. Yeah, oh, there. Is that the technical term? Okay, good. So she's, like, dropping foam bricks on her and lights, and eventually, like, they have to face off again, and ultimately Sydney gets the best of her. There's a couple, like, moments where the killers come back to life. Timothy Oliphant jumps up, and so she shoots him, and then she turns around, and this is the moment you were talking about being sociopath. She turns around and shoots Billy's mom in the head again, just in case. That's called the double tap, and you get it, girl. So...
In what world are you hanging around that you're calling the double tap?
The double tap is from the Zombieland.
Oh, it
Remember,
is.
That's the rule, that's right. The double tap.
Rule one is cardio, rule two is double tap.
Yes.
Oh. See? Terrible movie memory.
Yeah, we saw that together in the theater.
I know. I really enjoyed it.
It was very good.
It's like a new movie every time.
Okay. So, good news. Dewey's not dead. We get another him on a stretcher. That man is like a cat. He cannot be killed. So
can't grow a prop mustache.
Which is really funny. Well, it's really funny because that's like the ongoing joke about Gail.
Right. That she has 9 lives, but it's really Dewey. Like she.
Yeah.
She, I mean, I guess in the 4th movie, she finally gets. She gets it pretty good. She's pretty. I guess she's shot in this one.
Well, she's shot, but then she stands up and she's like, "It just grazed my ribs."
Oh yeah, it bounced off my ribs. I'm like, "Okay, Dr. Gail, whatever you say."
Her ribs?
Yeah, it bounced off my ribs. Like, what kind of wackadoo rubber bullet is this thing?
Like, I'm like, it was enough force to knock you like 4 feet back into the orchestra pit.
Well, to be fair, she is all ribs.
I know. Like, are they trying to make a body joke about her?
No, I think it's just bad writing.
That body joke came when Dewey asked when she started smoking, and Randy says when the nude pictures turned up on the internet, and she says, "Yeah, my face, Aniston's body."
Oh
yeah. Oh, dear. So, okay, so that's basically it for Scream 2. What did you guys think about this one?
It was okay. I mean, it's probably the best way to put it. The pacing on it was a little slow.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, especially seeing them back-to-back, I think if there was more of a time gap between the two. Even if I just waited a couple of days, I probably would have enjoyed it more, but Scream to me is still just so good. I mean, it's so perfect on its own. And then two, it's kind of like, eh.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
I thought it was solid. There was kind of this strange, like you're talking about, like mixture of like Saved by the Bell, The College Years, and horror movie that I thought was kind of trying to do a lot at one time. But this is, I mean, immediately in two, I was like, oh, so this is the nostalgia movie for people who are not me, who saw this less than one, you know, more than one day ago.
Yes.
Because they're going to be, oh, this is where they're going to get really excited or whatever. Uh-huh. And I was not excited. and the things that start to emerge in this get so heavy handed.
Right.
In three, and then kind of redeem in four a little, but.
Yeah. We'll discuss.
We'll discuss.
I actually liked this more than I remembered liking it. Like, I remember being like, eh, sequels suck. But maybe because I did not remember it as well as the first one, you know, I had a better time with it. I thought as far as sequels, a sequel to Scream goes, this is perfectly acceptable. I feel like it felt very much, it kept the spirit of the first one pretty well. It, you know, it felt like it had the vibe of it. You know, like a lot of times when it gets handed over to another director, like Ring and Ring 2 are even though they're in the same universe, they're totally different tonally. And I thought this was a good extension of the first one. In Scream logic, it made sense. And I thought Sydney was really good in it. So I enjoyed the sequel. I would say that if you haven't seen it in a long time, you may find by going back, it's better than you remembered. I definitely hear what both of you guys are saying. I just think my expectations for it were pretty low, so mm-hmm. I was pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm. No, it is better than what I remember, but like I said, there's stuff in there that's unnecessary. Singing.
Oh, the singing. I wonder if Jerry O'Connell looks back at that and just is like, oh, cringe.
Yeah, actually, he does. But I'm like, huh. But I'd much rather be known as the guy that sings I Think I Love You or the guy that gets his penis burped up by a piranha.
They took my penis! They took my... Have you seen Piranha 3D?
Is that the first one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No memory.
No.
Enjoyed it very much.
You don't remember that he gets his penis eaten off?
No.
And that you get, like, a 3D penis in your face that gets burped up
oh,
by...
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, when they pull him back on the ship, he's like, that took my penis. He has no legs. God, that was a great movie.
That was so much fun.
It was, like, ridiculously
fun. I loved
fun.
That so much more than I thought I would love it.
Right? Like, there was something... I've talked about this before. I don't know if you were on the show at the time. There's something, like, wholesome about it in a way. Like... It's there's no kink to it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the kink is the right word. There's no like perversity to it all, even though it's like yeah. It feels like all American boobies and gore, like in a way that you just now everybody has to have some sort of like creepy psychosexual problem where this
right and you know it's going to be exploitation because of the marketing and
right.
stuff like that. But no, it ended up being much more wholesome. Kind of like Dolly Parton ultimately is like so G-rated.
Right.
Even though like everything about her is kind of pornographic.
Yeah!
Like,
yeah.
Like she's so ultimately G-rated and wholesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. But totally off topic. But I warned you guys at the beginning, at the top, there would be non sequiturs. Okay, should we move on to my favorite of the... Just kidding! My least favorite of the series, Scream 3?
Sure.
Yes.
All right, so this one's two... I'm sorry, go ahead.
See, let's get this piece of crap over with.
No yeah. shit. I'm going to speed through this sucker. What's a 5-second Right, okay, Scream 3, 2000... this one's in 2000. So the first two were, like, back-to-back. This one had a little space. And it's, again, directed by Wes Craven, written by Kevin Williamson. In this one, it's a few years in the future. Cotton Weir is now a successful talk show host.
Actually...
who likes to wear all white.
Let me interrupt you real quick. According to Wikipedia, this was actually written by Aaron Kruger, and I remember reading that, or on the documentaries, they were saying that what happened with this one is that Williamson had sent him a script, and somebody had posted the script on the internet. That also happened with the second one. And so they were having to do almost daily rewrites, and Williamson couldn't really help him out because he... About that time, Dawson's Creek had peaked, and he was so tied up with that.
Hmm. Well, you can feel it, because this thing is terrible. Yeah, I wonder if that's where the whole joke is with Jenny McCarthy. It was like, another fucking rewrite!
Yeah, that...
Right, and when they're
that's
in the
basically,
house...
That's basically what happened, because like, day by day, they wouldn't know what it was they were filming when they were coming in, and Scott Foley even admits that like he had no idea until the day they shot the scene how it was going to end.
Yikes. Well, that explains the ending. Okay. All right, mm-hmm. So this one is a few years in the future. And it takes place in Hollywood, where they are filming Scream, or Stab 3, based on another of Gail Weathers' books. I think at this point now, because the Stab franchise has gotten in front of gotten past the Scream franchise... Which makes no fucking sense. But you know what I mean. It's now become fictional. I mean, some of the characters are the same, but it's all from, I guess, Gail Weathers' books. What we got here is Cotton Weir gets killed. He gets a call from Ghostface, who's threatening his girlfriend. He comes home, and the little twisty twist on this is instead of Ghostface just having Ghostface's voice, now he can magically, with some sort of box... imitate anyone's
voice.
Yeah.
The little round box, yeah.
So he tricks the girlfriend into thinking that it's Cotton Weir, and so they start fighting, and then Ghostface comes in and kills them. And that's your first kill, which to me was the like most underwhelming of all the kills.
Well,
the pre-credit kills.
It just made me think, like, I understand the whole thing was really kind of scary. And, you know, especially to hear something like that coming out of, like, the voice that you know. But, mm-hmm. like, what the hell went on in their relationship before that she could honestly believe that he was that guy?
Yeah, I know. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that, but that's actually a really good point. Mm-hmm. Well, he was kind of a dick about that Diane Sawyer interview in the first or the second movie.
I mean, he was kind of odd.
Yeah.
In the second one.
Yeah, he's definitely, he's very menacing in it.
It's like stilted and odd. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so he gets killed, and then we cut to where Sydney. Now, Sydney is post-college. She has gone into full lockdown mode.
Is that
in Monterey?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Okay, so she's in full lockdown mode, and she's become a crisis counselor who works out of her home.
And she has my volunteer job from college.
She does?
Yes!
Nice, how'd she do?
She did fine.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. I'm glad to know that we
you
got
get
that
it. You get a pseudonym, which she does.
Uh-huh.
And they patch calls into your house. I did it in Santa Cruz, so close to Monterey. It was just funny.
Wow. Yeah. You were really identifying with...
I was like, I'm on board with this.
And then, so you had some wacky calls. Santa Cruz, man.
Right.
That's where all the people that were too radical for Berkeley went to hide.
It's where the people that were too radical for Berkeley went to hide and where kind of far-right militia members share the hills.
Oh, yes. Jesus.
I did a lot of... rape education outreach in the schools there, and it was an experience.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
That's pretty horrifying. I want to hear all about that. Actually. I'm kind of intrigued by the idea that we have mountain folk so local.
Oh.
Oh yeah. You were talking like hardcore survivalist mountain folk that like, you know, filter their own urine kind of thing. It's...
What, you don't do that? <I'm just kidding. laughs> Wait, that's weird?
That's what's next coming to Oakland. That'll be like artisanal water.
Oh my god!
Like
is that
locally
the new...
sourced artisanal water? What will be your own urine?
Are you talking about like the caveman diet? Is that the next thing?
Paleo.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Oh my god!
That'll be the next thing. Is filtering your own urine because it's local,
right? And sterile. It's good for you. Good times. That's like the slow drink movement. Okay. Anywho. So, okay.
We
want
to talk about anything but screen.
I know, right? Okay, so she's in full lockdown mode. Clearly, she's very traumatized from the previous things. I liked in the second one that she had moved on with her life, but after having gone through it twice, she is just, like, completely, like, shutting out the world. And then back in Hollywood, we've got the movie going on. Lance Henriksen is the producer on the film. The RA from Felicity is the director. I don't know his name, but you know what I'm talking about. Dewey is on set as a technical advisor, and also sort of the sidekick to my favorite character in this movie was Parker Posey, who plays the Gale Weathers character.
Yes.
And I love that Parker Posey has like one role, and she just plays every role that way with just like a slight amount of nuance. But I love her in anything she's in. So she was the one saving grace for this movie, I thought. Did you guys like her? Or am I alone?
Love Parker Posey.
Yeah, I thought she was great.
And I liked there's a whole sequence where her and Gale Weathers are like investigating together and Parker Posey's trying to like get into character.
Yes.
That I found very, very amusing.
And like Emily Mortimer is one of them.
Yes. Oh, the whole time all I could think was, my hollow bones. My bones. Did you ever watch 30 Rock?
Mm-mm.
She's Jack's girlfriend for a while and she has hollow bone syndrome. Oh. So like every time he like kisses her, she'd be like, oh, my bones.
Well, she was in the newsroom, which I'm learning that I transfer grudges from
you know,
vehicle to vehicle in media. And
I did not watch that.
Oh, don't.
I know. I'm like, I'm not going to watch
it. I should have known better.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's Aaron Sorkin? What are you going to do? Okay, so... And Jenny McCarthy is there, of course, as just sort of dumb blonde. And what we discover as Ghostface is doing his worst is that he's killing people in the order of the script. Now, here's the problem. There's multiple versions of the script out there, so they don't know who is going to be the next victim.
So maybe this is the other part that was written, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Art imitating life.
Yeah, because they're like, we don't know who we're going to kill next because we haven't read the script. Also, the killer is leaving photos of Sydney's mother from a period of time where she had gone missing.
Right.
At the scene of all the crimes. So Gail and Parker Posey team up and start researching it, and they discover that she was an actress in Hollywood when she was young under a pseudonym, Rena Reynolds. And... I know. McDreamy is there looking suspicious as hell. I was sure he was the killer.
Me too.
I was like, you know, anyone with that much, like, you know, wave in their coiffure has to be the killer.
It was all the hair grease from the first one you were trying to transfer.
Yes, exactly. I no longer trust hair.
It was still hanging around the set.
Yeah. So, there's actually, I quite enjoyed, what am I, Exploding Joe? I enjoyed the scene, I'm not making fun of Exploding Joe, I love her, where she ends up on set. And she's sort of being chased through the sets by Ghostface. I thought that was kind of a cool touch because it's like a little bit, it's very meta. Like it's, you know, it is a movie set on a movie, which, you know, I don't know. I liked it. I thought that was actually a pretty good chase sequence where she kind of knows the lay of the land, but her knowledge of it fails her when she like opens the door.
And there's no floor. Yes. I actually really liked that part.
That was a really good part.
Mm-hmm.
And he falls and hits the bed or whatever. But you know what? This part drove me crazy because they also, like, she tells the police about it. There is a serial killer killing people and the victim from all of the previous movies saying, I saw him. And they're like questioning whether or not she really did. I'm like, suddenly her sanity is in question. In a scenario, it'd be one thing if no one had been killed and he was stalking her and she was saying it. But, like, there's 5 dead bodies. Who fucking questions it?
Hollywood actors.
Yes! Like, yeah. It's like, shut up, McDreamy. So,
which I have to say has probably one of the best scenes is when Jenny McCarthy's running around and she runs into the prop room. She keeps picking up stuff and she picks up the rubber knife and it just wobbles and then she hits him in the arm with a machete and it bends and
yeah that's I also liked the her when she's like backing up into the rows of Ghostface costumes. I thought that was a nice little touch. I mean, like, they do interesting things. It's just that it's just underwritten, you know what I mean, or overwritten. I can't decide, one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Carrie Fisher shows up in a kind of interesting cameo. I mean, it's always nice to see her, but I was just like, really? Okay. Through Gail and Parker Posey's investigation, they discover that her mother, Maureen, actually worked for the producer, Lance Henriksen, in a series of horror films. So they confront him about it. He eventually confesses that he had parties at that time where young ingenues could come and meet men and basically, like, fuck for parts. You know? Which I'm sure happens. It's like the casting couch or whatever. So he, like, it made me think of American Mary a little bit. So apparently she got sexually assaulted there and took off and went back. She returned to Woodsboro and had a family and then cheated on them and was all damaged and fucked up from it. So Gail and Dewey get a call saying that Sydney has gone to a party at the director's house because the production has now been shut down. Half the cast is dead. Jenny McCarthy got stabbed. The dude playing Dewey got blown up. Other people died. doesn't really matter. Who cares? These characters could not be less or more disposable. This is one of the problems with this movie. Well, I'll get to it after. Okay. Dewey and Gail end up getting captured by Ghostface, who calls Sydney and is like, you better come here or I'm gonna kill these people that, you know. So she, shows up there and there's a nice prolonged chase scene. Unfortunately, Parker Posey gets killed behind some mirrors. I'm guessing it's supposed to be like a mirror of that whole death scene where Dewey appears to die on the other side of one-way mirror, in the second film, which was such a bummer because she was like the only new character that I gave a crap about. Like everyone else, I was like, just even Bud from the Cosby Show, I did not give a fuck about. And I love Bud, but there's like secret passages in the house and So they're, like, trying to get away from the killer and finding all the secret passages. And Sydney shows up, and they have a fight scene. It's basically exactly what you expect. We get the reveal. Turns out it's the director, the RA from Felicity. And he is actually her brother. Maureen apparently got pregnant and abandoned the child while she was in Hollywood before going back to Woodsboro. He tracked her down and she shut the door in his face and he went crazy and decided that he was going to get Sydney back for being...
For stealing his life.
Even though, like, really?
That's really thin.
And who... Notice. Okay, let's take a step back here. Her life is, she had kind of a normal life until her mother got raped and murdered. Her boyfriend tried to kill her. Then she almost got killed again in college. He is a director in Hollywood who has won a bunch of MTV Music Awards.
He just wanted his mommy.
Oh, I'm just like, who the fuck wants you? People want your life, not her life. No one wants Sydney's
life.
Why
not kill her new husband?
Right. Right.
Why kill Sydney's dad?
Why Sydney? Because they just needed something to shoehorn in there. And because it's the third one, they had to, like, you know...
That's reaching.
It's bad. It's rough. Rough stuff. Rough. So she kills him, but no, he's not dead. He pops up, so then she kills him again. The end. Oh, and Dewey proposes to Courtney Cox, and she says yes, even though they know it's never going to work out. Because it's more romantic that way. And, oh, we close with her and McDreamy and them about to watch a movie in her house, which she is now left wide open, I guess, because now she's come full circle and is feeling like the ultimate survivor girl. And that's it.
She's come out of the darkness.
Save it right. For movie four. Okay, so what do you guys think about this? I think it's pretty clear none of us like this movie, but what are your thoughts?
This movie just feels longer than it actually is because there's so many weird shifts in it. It's like you have yeah. The thing with Sydney, then you have the movie shift, the movie plot, and then they go back and forth, and it's just like after a while you're like, am I even watching the same movie?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the movie where they talk about, like, is it this movie? Or no, it's the next movie. Never mind. I'm getting ahead of myself. Where they
okay,
have the
and can we mention the Randy thing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you want to.
Oh, my God. I can't believe I skipped over the Randy thing. Okay, so every one of these movies, there, one of the tropes is we have, obviously, the kill at the beginning, and then also a point where we have, like, Mr. Audience Member coming in and explaining the rules of that movie. And the first one, it's, you know, don't do drugs, don't have sex, never say that... I'll be right back, because that's like the kiss of death. The second movie is the gore, or there has to be more, the body count has to be higher, the kills have to be bloodier, and I can't remember what the other ones are. So now that Randy's dead, we have a problem. Who's going to be the movie, like, you know, expert? You would think they'd be able to scrape somebody up on a movie set. You know what I mean? Like, there had to be a movie geek on set somewhere, right? Oh no! Instead they have Welcome to the Dollhouse Girl show up with a VHS tape.
Yeah, she shows up, hands in the tape, and leaves. It's just like, we miss you, Sydney, and then walks away. It's like, but it's just random. She just pops out of a trailer and is like, here guys, and then...
With her 90s, like, white girl cornrows, which I totally rocked back in the day. Remember the, you know, like, the twist?
Not.
I did so! And I looked, yes!
Well, I know at the end that Courtney Cox has the, like, do you remember that moment when there were these terrible little screws with gemstones on the
edge
of them?
Oh my god, do I remember that moment. Yes.
Into your hair that she's wearing a few of it.
She also has the really, like, hacked up baby doll bang that is so unfortunate. The one that, like, it's, like, right, it's the Frankenstein bang. Yeah. Oh, so I can't believe we did not talk about her bang. So anyways, she shows up with the VHS tape where, Jamie Kennedy is back, and he is posthumously telling you, if you're watching this, that means I didn't survive college, and then he makes a joke about, like,
it might be a trilogy.
Yeah, and you get trilogy rules, where you have to go back and learn something that you thought was true, wasn't true after all. Oh, that's the other thing. On top of it being the brother, he actually is the one that videotaped Maureen with Billy Loomis's dad, and he took it to Billy Loomis and basically got him to kill Maureen because he is the director. He directs the action. Yes. You forgot about that, didn't you? You had blocked it out.
I think I told you, I started watching the Scream movies last week.
Yeah.
And I got through two in a couple days. This one took me about a week.
It's rough.
Because I'd space out or go do something else or just leave the room.
You must have been terrified going into the fourth one. Like, it can't be worse than the third one.
Well, I remember you saying that the fourth one was better.
Oh, it's definitely better than the third one.
But, I mean, it was like, okay, tomorrow I'll finish it. It was like a term paper. It was fucking terrible.
Imagine me at like 3 o'clock in the morning last night, like, make it end. I want to go to bed.
And it's going to end with the hardened career woman screwing little rhinestones into her hair.
Right.
That's where it
ends. This is the one where I think is the worst offender, where she is like completely villainized.
Yeah.
For being
careerist and ambitious.
Ambitious. Yeah. Her ambition is viewed as a character flaw by her small town love interest, because she wants more than he can give her, and that makes her a bad character.
Right, like, she is the embodiment of, like, some Time magazine from 1985.
Yes.
Right? About, like, careerist women who will be childless and alone.
And watching them back to back to back, I was like, holy fuck. Like, I never really thought about it before, because I always thought she's kind of a bitch, you know what I mean? I had never really processed what it was that made her the bitch. I'm like, oh, it's because she is ambitious. And unapologetically so. That makes her a terrible villain in this universe, where she should be satisfied to settle down with the small town sheriff. And it's really apparent in the next movie. Ah! Damn it.
Yeah, the next one does fail the Bechdel test in every way.
Man. It sure does, doesn't it? Okay, so, although, but strangely, like, also, like, the most female-centric of all of them.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It is, definitely. Okay, so what's your review of this one? I know you guys think it's terrible. Any redeeming qualities?
I will remember it even less than I do other movies.
Yeah, I remember, I was sitting there, I could not for the life of me remember who the killer was. I was like, I think it's McDreamy, and I was like, I think maybe he's her brother or something. So I got part of it right, but I had blocked it out because it was so utterly fucking forgettable.
Yeah, it pretty much is, and it just, like, apparently, though, you've seen that show The Following?
Yes.
Yes.
Apparently, like, Kevin Williamson, his initial script for Scream 3 was about a cult that was killing off the members of the crew, the cast and crew of the film, and how it was supposed to end is that big chase scene through the set where the centralized characters, well, the actors get killed off in the same way that their counterparts did. So someone's going to get stuck in a garage door and somebody's going to, you know, so.
Gotcha. Were any of them going to be dressed as Edgar Allan Poe with giant papier-mâché Edgar Allan Poe faces? Because that I want to see.
Although there is a Following cameo in Scream 4.
I would say that's a perfect segue into Scream 4 because we have one of the love triangle peeps.
Nico Tortella.
Is that
Tortorella,
his name?
Looks like his name is, yeah.
Who is the least compelling character in both Scream 4 and The Following. So it's good to know that he's consistently lame. Mm-hmm. As Trevor! Okay, so, I mean, is there anything else to say about this, or can we move on to Scream 4?
Oh, let's move on.
Okay.
Let's move on.
All right, so flash forward 11 years, 2011, Scream 4. Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson are back. This time we have this is where the logic breaks down, is in this opening scene. So obviously the trope is we have the pre-credits kill. It starts off with Aria from Pretty Little Liars, woohoo, and some girl I don't know. And they're talking about Saw and torture porn, so you know it's like going to be super zeitgeisty. What are you looking at my notes?
Who's Aria from Pretty Little Liars? Is it Kristen Bell?
No. It's the brunette girl who steps outside.
Oh, yeah,
when they open the door. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have our sort of predictable setup where they're getting phone calls. She opens the door. Turns out he's actually inside the house. He stabs them. You're expecting the you know, Scream Chiron or whatever it's called, title card to come up. But instead, it goes to stab 5 or 6 or whatever. And, turns out it was, so next up you have Anna Paquin and Kristen Bell sitting on the couch talking about it. And Anna Paquin's like going off about how like, I can't watch these movies where, you know, teenagers are deconstructing the horror genre and da 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 da. And Kristen Bell's getting more and more annoyed until she turns around and starts stabbing her in the stomach. She's like, just watch the fucking movie. Turns out that is also the next one. So another stab thing comes up, and now we've moved on to who are the last two? It's the girl from Secret Circle and it's
Hayden Panettiere and
no, it's the girls that get killed. So it's it's the girl from Friday. You haven't seen Friday Night Lights, but it's the obnoxious daughter from Friday Night Lights and the girl from the Secret Circle, because I watch all that WB or CW crap anyway. This is one where I was talking about there's like logic breakdown. They talk about how like it's teens deconstructing horror, but in this universe, Stab is based off real events. So real events wouldn't be deconstructing horror, right? Because it's not a fictional story. So why would there be teens deconstructing horror in Stab if it's based on real stories? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of getting itself... It's uh-huh. too self-referential, you know right. what I mean?
It's trying to be too meta and
it's breaking
failing.
Its own logic. So I was like, wait a minute! Okay, it doesn't really matter. It's not that important. It's not as profound as I thought it was when I thought of it last night. Okay, so they get killed, and it turns out they're our first kills of the movie. And yeah, whatever. Okay, so the next thing we have... what did I say? Garage door death. Oh, right. We get a nice callback to the earlier movies where one of the girls gets her spine crushed by the garage door, which couldn't really happen, I hope. it was pretty awful. It was like, crunch. It's like, ooh, that's bad times. But I did also, one thing I did like about this part, though, was where he's like, you're the dumb blonde with the big tits. And she's like, I have a 4.0 and 135, what is that called?
IQ.
IQ, asshole. I was like, yeah, smart dumb blonde. Okay.
That's right.
Okay, so now we've got Sydney, who is in town. You know, this is 10 years later. She's in town for a book signing. Dewey and Gail are married, and Dewey is now the sheriff of the town. And he's got a deputy. I wrote deputy sexy pants with lemon squares. So he's got like a little deputy, like... who's in love with him and makes him baked goods.
Was she in Super Troopers? Is she the same blonde deputy as in Super Troopers?
I don't know.
I'm gonna look it up.
Look it up. She's funny. I liked her in this.
I loved her.
And we see, this is where Courtney Cox unveils her plastic surgery. She has developed full-on Joker mouth, which is just sad, and she's trying to emote, and it's just not gonna happen. You can't, like, freeze your face and then expect, like, to be able to show emotion in it.
She looks like a Pez dispenser.
That's what I'm saying. She's like the Joker mouth. You know what I mean? Where it's like stretched and kind of up in a perma smile.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad times.
Yeah.
Okay. But we're also introduced to our new characters. We've got basically the next generation. So it's Sydney's niece, played by Julia Roberts' niece. And Hayden Panettiere, I can never say that right,
mm-hmm.
who, as Kirby, who is totally my favorite character in this movie. I really liked great. Kirby. And they have,
power
like...
suits.
What's that?
What's the deal with the power suits that she wears?
Is she wearing power suits?
Well, like, that first day when they go to school, she's, like, in, like, this weird, like, blazer and skirt thing that looks like she's going to the office instead of, like...
Maybe she's
sophomore
just
year.
Really into Hillary Clinton. That's what, I mean, she's basically my proxy on screen, right? She's like super horror fan who loves Hillary Clinton. I'm in.
Uh-huh.
So, okay.
It is not the same actress that was in
no
Super
no.
Troopers, although it's a very similar character.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about, but yeah, I really liked her. I thought she was great. Funny in this. I liked her as sort of like... standing her ground with Gail.
Yeah, I thought she was the killer early on. But
of course, well, they yeah, do. I mean, they do really go out of their way to make her and Trevor look guilty.
Well, they try to give her some the motives being so thin in three,
right?
Like, you didn't pay attention. You don't remember me from sophomore year. Like, is this the new one?
Right. And shrouded in darkness where you can just see her mouth and, like, the glint of her eyes. Okay, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. So, okay, so we've introduced Kirby and Jill, who is the niece of Sydney, and, like, you know, their random hot friend. They've all been getting phone calls from the dead girls, from Ghostface. But they're not taking it seriously because, obviously, the stab movies are huge in that town since it's where it took place. And also, Jill has an ex-boyfriend named Trevor who's trying to get back together her. She's not really having it. That's really kind of big. Oh, and then there's the two nerds. There's the two nerdy guys that are, like, cinemaphiles. They run the cinema club, and one of them life blogs everything, so he basically has this, like, harness on his head where he streams everything in his life, which I'm guessing not the most compelling streaming TV, but whatever. So when people start showing up dead, Courtney Cox wants to partner back up with Dewey like they have previously. She's right now trying to write a book, but she has nothing to write about because it's been so long since she's had another run-in with Ghostface. So this is, like, kind of her chance to get back to work because, you know, her and her wanting to have a career self getting in the way of, you know, her opportunity to be a perfectly happy housewife.
That's right.
So she wants to team back up with him. He's like, no, I'm the sheriff now. I can't. And she can't believe it because she's like, I was with you through all of this. We solved these together, but she's completely getting shut out. So she actually decides to go and team up with the town, like the two nerdy dudes. They're outside of the police station when, there's, like, a press conference when she's, like, talking to them, and at the same time, Sydney's PR person, played by Allison Brie, who is great in this, I mm-hmm. thought, gets killed and shoved off a roof and kind of ruins the press conference.
Well, and who takes the place of the kind of careerist, heartless yeah. woman.
And basically she's like, if you guys help me, then, I'll come to your cinema club and be a celebrity guest. And they're like, well, it would be really cool if you could get Sydney. And she's just like, okay, you know. Because obviously she doesn't like being second billing to Sydney, but whatever. So they go to the class, and we get the new rules. This time they actually, thank God, another VHS didn't show up. the cinema kids are basically like, well, this would be a remake. And the remake rules, everything, like the old standards are out. The opposite is true. Like, being a virgin won't save you. The only thing that could save you maybe is being gay. So then they say something about how, or they're like, you know, in the next act has to be at a party following the formula. And they're like, well, okay, where's the next party? Turns out they're having this movie marathon that they have every year on the anniversary of the Woodsboro Massacre. And it's called Stabathon, and they do all of the movies. And so they want to go to that, and basically the kids, like, shut them down. They're like, they refuse to say where it is because it's invite only. So they leave.
Underground.
What?
It's really kind of underground.
Yeah, it's really underground, exactly. Because there's such a, you know, underground scene in Woodsboro.
Yeah.
There's, like, 25 teenagers. How underground can it be?
But there are bales of hay to show that it is a small thing.
Oh, yes. 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 Good times. So, oh, and one of the other new rules is, in order, in this version, because now it has to be very now, the killer would actually film their own movie. Like, they would actually film the killings. Think, like, you know, shaky cam style, or, you know, first person, found footage style, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, we get a little bit of the at-home stuff. Sid is staying with her aunt, which is the sister of her mother, and that Jill is her daughter. That's how it all works. At first I was like, how does that
work? So
that's
her cousin. Yeah.
So it's her cousin, I guess. And there's some really kind of sweet moments where Sydney is talking to Jill, and she's like, you know, I know people say, like, I know how you're feeling, but you know there's no way they could actually know what you're feeling. I know what you're feeling. Because she obviously lost her friends when she was her age. And it's kind of like a, you get kind of a sweet moment. I right away hated Jill. Jill's the lamest character in the movie. I thought she was a total bitch through this whole thing. But I did actually like these moments. They end up getting attacked. And she really, and Sydney does a really, like, she like protects her and like tries to prevent her from getting killed. I skipped over, but there's a great kill. Basically, I think it's like the second kill of the movie, where Kirby and Jill are in bed, or they're hanging out together watching Shaun of the Dead, and they get a call from Ghostface, and he says he's in the closet, and they go to check the closet, and there's no one in there, and he's like, well, I didn't say I was in your closet. Turns out he's next door. They can see directly into the room of their other hot friend, and she gets like brutally killed.
And like hung out the window.
Yeah. And Sydney, being the badass survivor girl, goes like running in, breaks into the house. The cops are like off, like with their thumbs up their asses. She runs in, is too late to save the girl, obviously. And it is like the bloodiest thing in Scream history. There's blood everywhere, all over the room. And, but it turns out Ghostface is still in the house. They have their confrontation. She's able to, like, kick him in the knees. And, like, she's becoming, like, a badass in this one. She's, like, full-on Ripley style in this one. Jill gets cut, but she doesn't end up getting killed because Sydney basically beats up Ghostface. But when she turns her back for a second, he escapes, so the cops don't catch him. So back at, sorry, I had to step back. So now back to where I was at Stabathon. This part's actually pretty funny. Courtney Cox follows them out to the Stabathon and she puts on a ghost face mask to get in. And she's like trying to be like young and cool and hip. So she's like giving everybody the thumbs. Doing like the old lady dance. That made me laugh. I had to say that was pretty great. So she walks around Stabathon and is like hiding her cameras so that she can watch and. She goes back to her car and starts, like, recording herself and, like, I never believed that 10 years later I would be back fighting Ghostface. But then Ghostface shows up and starts hiding all of her cameras, like, putting them face down or putting things in front of them. So she goes back in to, like, fix them up in the hayloft of this barn where everybody's watching Stab downstairs. And she discovers while she's fixing her cameras that there's actually a camera trained on her as well, a webcam. And she gets confronted by Ghostface, who ends up stabbing her in the shoulder before she gets away. Obviously, that breaks up the Stabathon, and the teens go back to Kirby's house to hang out. And it's Kirby, Jill, the two nerdy dudes, and Trevor shows up all creepy, like, somebody paged me from here, and I'm total jockey asshole. And busts up the nerd on Kirby action that almost happened, which I was totally rooting for. I was like, yes, Kirby, yeah. Go for the nerd. Because as anyone who knows me knows, I have a total warm fuzzy for nerdy dudes. Nerds, just nerds in general.
He was a cute nerd, too.
Yeah. Rory, he's the youngest Colkin. Yeah. Which I loved him in Signs. I know everybody hates that movie. I love Signs. And he's so cute in it. Have you seen Signs? Mm-mm. Everyone fucking hates it because there's a logic fail in it, but I don't care. I still love it. Okay, so the jockey Trevor dude goes off, and the live stream dude goes outside, and live stream gets attacked. He gets stabbed from behind. Ghostface is in the house. Sydney shows up and is able to corral Kirby, and they go run down, or she saves Jill again, because they get trapped in a bedroom. She tells Jill to hide under the bed, sneaks out the window, and then, like, there's a chase where Ghostface is, like, chasing her around the roof, which I thought was really great and tense, and she eventually drops off the side of the roof and gets away. And then her and Kirby go downstairs, and they look out the door. The nerdy guy that Kirby was about to hook up with is now taped to the chair, like, the beginning of the first Scream movie. He begs her to let him in, and Sydney tells her, if you can't trust him, don't let him in. Again, hard decision making. Mm-hmm. And Kirby, being a badass, doesn't let him in. So he ends up taped to the chair. And she gets the phone call with the quiz, but because she's a horror movie expert, she's able to actually beat, Ghostface at the quiz. So she goes out to let the nerdy guy go, and twist, he's actually one of the killers. And he's like, why did you take 4 years to notice me? And stabs her. Which I was like, no, I kept hoping for the Dewey ending for her.
Yeah.
I didn't want her to die. She was really the only new character. Oh, no, that's not true. I actually liked the deputy, but I really liked her a lot. She was a much better final girl. Like, you were supposed to kind of think of Jill as the final girl, but Kirby had, like, all of the personality traits.
Yeah.
She was, like,
spunk.
Yeah, she was spunky. And I love Hayden Panettiere.
Yeah. Whatever. And Jill was too, like, Kristen Stewart in Twilight. Like, it was too wooden.
She had all the victim characteristics, but none of the survivor girl kind of, you know what I mean? Like, she was so pre with no, like, spark of being able to kind of kick into survivor girl mode. Whereas Kirby was totally the opposite. And you kind of got the feeling that Kirby had a little reputation around town for being a troublemaker and being kind of sassy, which I liked.
Yeah, she reminded me of Natasha Lyonne's character in American Pie.
Good comparison.
Which is one of the only, like, teenage female characters I really... It's like, well done. Like, good job.
Right. What, Tara Reid wasn't doing it for you? Is that what you're... Okay, so where was I? Oh yeah, so that happens. Sydney is she fights him off, I think, she's trying to make her get away. She turns around and there's a second ghost face. So we've got two ghost faces again. Only the third movie was there one ghost face. You kept thinking, like, this time it's not going to be the same, but it was. But it's a pretty good reveal at this point. Ghostface 2 pulls off their mask and it's Jill. And it all comes down to having grown up as Sydney's cousin and having Sydney get all the attention and be the special one. Now it's her turn to be, she's like, I'm going to become you. And up until this point, I was really with this movie. There was, like, tons of great kills, like the cop that got stabbed in the head.
I know.
That was rough stuff, man. I was like, this is great. And I was even with it to a certain extent here, but it just goes on and on. And, like, don't you get it? Yes, we get it. Got it. We got it the first time.
It is tackling a big issue.
Yeah, you wanted to discuss the issue?
No. I feel like they over-discussed it already.
Right. So it's basically, in this modern era, you don't have to do anything to be famous. You really don't. Which is true. And that's, I mean, it's so, like...
The Kardashians.
Right.
Right. And, but, like, we don't have enough sense of, you know, as a kid, I don't know what privacy is.
Right.
I think she says it's some version of that at some point.
Well, it is true, though, because...
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are the post-9/11 kids.
Right, but...
You know,
But, I mean, I kind of get the whole, like, George Romero heavy-handedness with this one.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like, it's so, like, oh, I mean, if they had shortened...
Diary of the Dead.
Yeah, they had shortened this whole spiel to, like in half, I would have been... It went on and on and on to the point where I was like, yeah, I got it. But
right,
basically,
go post this shit on YouTube. Go away.
Right, and she's like, you know, now you can't just tell your story. They have to see your story. And I'm not... it's not about killing you, it's about becoming you, and So she stages her,
I am part of a generation who grew up without privacy, or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, really? Good dialogue.
This is a lot. So she stabs Sydney, and it looks like Sydney's dead, and I was like, dang. I kind of, like, had a little respect, like, I was like, they're really going dark
too.
With this.
Uh-huh.
And as much as I like Sydney and I want her to survive, I kind of was like, that's pretty ballsy.
Uh-huh.
And she stages her whole thing. She, like, scratches her face with her boy, because they're going to make it look like the boyfriend did it, right?
Yeah. And, dude, that is some psychotic shit.
It
actually reminded me of, there's a movie, The Class of 1984, and there's a scene very similar where this guy fakes getting beat up and in front of somebody else. He's, like, smashing his face into the mirror and, like, he busts his teeth on the sink. And she does the same thing, the jump into the glass table, ramming her face into the mirror. And it's just like, I think that is actually more brutal than letting your buddy stab you.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It made me think of,
Fight Club.
Yep. When he's, like, throwing himself around his boss's office. But yeah, I mean, she's fucking nutballs, man. Because she kept going. I kept waiting for, you know what I mean? Like, she scratched her face, and I was like, wow. Then she stabbed herself in the shoulder, and I was like, wow. Then she, like, slams her face into a mirror and then jumps through a glass table. I was like, well, bitch does commit. She does.
I know. When I thought that this might be the end, I was like, this is actually a pretty respectable ending.
Right.
Right? If Sydney had died and she was...
And then she, like, lays down and, like, mirrors her hand so that, like...
Mm-hmm. And you'd just seen the reporters. And you'd just seen the news footage that they were showing outside of the hospital. But then they went on to...
Right. So, you know, like, it's a pretty dark ending. They take her away and she's surrounded by the news cameras. Like, and you can see she's, like, trying not to smile because they're like, how does it feel to be a survivor? How does it feel to be a hero? Like, it's everything she had hoped for because she doesn't need friends. She needs fans.
I didn't like that she was trying not to smile. This girl could have not smiled.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this girl could have been like, I would have liked a little more Hannibal Lecter there. Like, I would have liked a little more sociopathy.
Speaking of which, did you watch Hannibal?
No.
You gotta watch it.
Okay.
I think you'll like it a lot, because it's all therapy. There's a lot of him therapizing people. That's the right. That's the term, right?
Yeah. Sure. Head shrinking.
Yeah. It's a killer therapist. You gotta be into that, right? So they go to the hospital and she wakes up and she's like playing her role with Dewey and like, he's like, you know, you gotta be strong. And she's like, oh, how's Gail? Maybe someday we can write a book together, you know, with our matching shoulder wounds. And he's just, you know, like, you know, playing the role really effectively. And he's into it. And he goes and sees Gail, who's recovering and is, you know, full of piss and vinegar, like Gail always is. Mm-hmm. And he mentions, oh, she asks about you and says something about your matching wounds. And that's when they kind of come to this realization, like, how does she know that they've both been stabbed in the same shoulder? Like, that information wasn't released. And, Dewey also drops the bomb that Sydney is not dead, that she's in intensive care.
Touch and go, but she's expected to pull through.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so she, of course, Jill's like, ah, fuck. So she gets out of bed and decides to go. And the thing is everything has been so perfectly, carefully planned up until this point. So this fumbly-ass ending makes no fucking sense. So she goes in and starts, like, tearing all of Sydney's stuff apart. She's like, you just won't fucking die! And jumps on top of her and starts choking her.
Right, in a movie about, like, the information age...
Right.
Are there no fucking cameras in this hospital?
Right.
I just don't... Yeah, anyway.
I mean, it's a problematic ending. So, they get in a total brawl. For someone who was touch and go, Sydney puts up a good fight. I guess that's adrenaline for you. But eventually Jill gets the better of her. Dewey comes in and Jill goes after him with a pretty brutally with a bedpan. Starts smashing his dome in. But then Gail comes in. And so does the deputy, but...
Yeah, Sydney ends up killing her.
I mean, killing her, and then there's something where they're all huddled, and she says, like, they're always right behind you.
Yes, and she stands up again.
She turns around and killed.
Yep.
Shoots her in the head.
Which is pretty fucking tragic. I mean, that whole family is fucked. The dad is alive, but we skipped over the part where... Jill's mom gets murdered. She gets stabbed in the
through
back.
Through the mail slot?
Through the mail slot!
That was brutal.
I was like, President Rosalind, no! But that was, like, kind of the lamest, weakest part. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. They show the reporters outside talking about Jill the survivor, but again, Sydney, once again, is sort of, like, the sole survivor, along with Gail and Dewey, who take their licks, as usual. It all falls back into the same sort of pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So that is Scream 4. 10 years later, totally bombed. So we probably will not see another Scream movie again, unless it's a reboot in a few years. What'd you guys think?
Of four?
Of four. And then we can talk about the series as a whole.
I enjoy
4. Yeah.
You know, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
We're also polite. Sarah, go.
I know. Go, Sarah.
You know, I enjoyed it. I thought the characters were likable. They weren't quite as obnoxious. Because, I mean, really, Matthew Illiard was just fucking...
Oh!
God, I would have strangled him. And they weren't as greasy.
Mm-hmm.
You say that now, but think about when we're in our silver speed suits. Yeah. Well, we look like the villains from Night of the Comet. We'll be laughing.
I actually have a fan edit of this that it's they don't do too much tweaking of it, but they cut off the end, so you don't have that last final battle. You have it end where Dewey tells her, yeah, it's touch and go, but Sid's, but it looks like Sid's gonna make it, and how her eyes just kind of go wide.
Uh-huh.
And then it ends right there. And I think that makes it a much tighter movie. Than the original theatrical cut. But still, it's enjoyable. I have a good time with it.
Yeah. How about you?
I liked it, especially coming off 3. I was...
3 definitely
helped. Only one way to go from there. It was good.
I don't know. They could have done it in space.
That's true.
Or in the hood, which is the other terrible.
That's
like,
so funny. Last night, I recorded an episode with the pod of the Splattercast where we did Puppet Master. And I was like, you could do it in space or in the hood.
Yeah, I got all the Puppet Master movies on a DVD for $5 at Walmart.
Well, get ready. Where you do Rise of... Access Rising should be up tonight. A little something special for you with the most racist puppet in the world. Okay, sorry, we're totally off topic. I totally cut you off. Go ahead.
I liked it. I thought, I appreciated that while the big issue thing was heavy-handed, it was at least contained.
Yeah.
To one portion of the movie as opposed to in 2, where it's like, does media cause violence? Now we're in class thinking about it.
I know. Do not want.
But no, I thought it was good. And I liked the characters more in this one, much more. I loved Hayden
Kirby.
Can't say your last name. Loved her. Actually loved the Geek Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And Jill, and the relationship between the girls I liked more. It was interesting because there was more stuff about like relationships between women in this one from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of like aggression in both, in all of the pre-credit stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really liked it, and I just loved the Kirby character so much.
Yeah.
It was maybe my favorite character of the series.
This is the second time I've seen this. The first time I watched it, I did not like it. I borderline hated it, to be honest. I was like, this is a piece of shit. And it was that scene at the end really just like stuck with me. So maybe it was because I did it right after 3, but I have to admit, I actually liked it this time. Mm-hmm. I hate it when I'm wrong, but I did actually like it a lot better this time. I really liked Kirby, that she was like, you know, a huge part of why I think I liked the movie. This one kind of felt like it was for the ladies a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, it really, we had the first female, well, no, that's not, I guess the mom was the first female killer, but I don't know. I did actually really like this one. I thought it was, I liked the amped up gore. It just, as a horror fan, I enjoyed that. I did like the twist ultimately. I could have done without the speech, but I did not see it. It was an effective twist.
Yeah.
I really did not ever suspect Jill. I just thought she was a lame character. I'm glad that there was a Kirby character because it saved the suckiness of the Jill character. I liked the geeks a lot. I liked the return to Woodsboro. I was ready to go back there. I was done with Hollywood in college. what else?
Did you like the self-help book, kind of?
Yes.
Which is so cheesy.
Out of darkness. Terrible. But I mean, like, what else is Sidney Prescott gonna do, right?
Absolutely.
Like, if anybody's ripe for a self-help book, it's Sidney.
But I would have preferred the media critique to kind of stay there and the kind of parody of how bad that would be. Like, that would absolutely be true and terrible.
I'm trying to think what else. I mean, I think this is the hardest on the Dewey Gale characters, though. Mm. Like, they're definitely... Dewey has lost his twinkling Barney Fife-like charm, and Gale is, you know, she's Gale. I guess she's okay in this one. I mean, it's hard to look at her, but the character itself, if you just think about the character, she was okay in it. But Dewey, I mean, like, I was so on board with Dewey in the first one because I loved how goofy he was. And goofy and sweet, and it, like, it decreased as the movies went on. But with this one, he totally jumped the shark for me.
You know, like, I wouldn't be cheating on my wife, but I'd be cheating on my diet if I took the Mountain Bars.
It was, like, everything bad about the Barney Fife-dom. And none of the, like, cute, like, naive twinkle. Like, I loved in the first movie.
When I wear
movie,
this badge, Mom says you need to treat me like a man.
Yes!
Of the
law.
Yeah, totally!
I love that. And, like, the, I was 24 for a whole year. You know, like, that, like, he was, like, a little rascally and goofy and... I liked that dynamic, and the big brother dynamic was gone, and he had just sort of become, like, middle-aged white dude who wanted his wife in her place and had, like, some hot little blondie girl that had a crush on him. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. He just was kind of eh. But,
and then we had a second, we had the Alison Brie, the publicist character, is the second, like, ambitious bitch.
Yeah.
In this one.
And, again, social, like, she's... seen as being totally socially awkward, like, socially inappropriate.
Yeah.
Just so driven by her ambition, she can't even see, like, where the social lines are drawn, and... Yeah. I love Alison Brie, though. Like, if it had been anyone else, it would have been unbearable, because I like her so much, she brought a little something to the character. She made her a little... Like, so when she died, you were kind of like, eh, but she... Yeah. I don't know, I did like it, though. I would say, if I were gonna rank them, I would say I liked... Hmm... 2, 4, 1, 3. What about you?
I would go 1, 4, 2, 3.
I would go with Sarah. Yeah, 1, 4, 2, 3.
Okay, good time. So what did you... Now, okay. What did you... As someone who had never seen them before, and now they're completely divorced from the time where they came out, what do you think about Scream? Does it deserve the level of, like, fandom and... iconic status that it has, do you think?
It's hard to divorce them from the time they came from because it's so obvious what time they came from.
I know. It's
oh,
so 90s.
Was so painful that way. I was like, oh, it's just pre-Columbine, so we're about to... This conversation is about to get even more ridiculous.
Yes.
I think they're solid.
Yeah. How about you, Sarah, what, you're the one that selected this topic. What was it about this that made you want to revisit it in marathon format?
Actually, it was just that I was bored one night on YouTube and came across the Scream documentary. Was it Still Screaming or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And saw that one and had a little... nostalgic ping for the movies, and then it just happened to turn out that all four of them popped up on Netflix streaming.
Oh!
that was pretty much the only logic behind it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good times. So what do you think? Did they hold up to the nostalgia?
For me, they do. Mm-hmm. I think it would be different if I was seeing them now, especially if I was younger, because, like, my buddy's girlfriend is you know, probably about 7-8 years younger than me, and we were watching it, and like, she didn't get the significance when Skeet Ulrich dropped the cell phone. I said, well, you have to remember, this is 1997. Not everybody had a cell phone, so the fact that he's got one,
yeah,
you know, he's probably one of like 10 kids in his high school to have one.
There are some great cell phones in that first movie.
Right.
The one that Courtney Cox beats Jamie Kennedy with is like the old, like, yellow brownie brick phone.
Oh, right.
that's actually a good point. Yeah, if you don't have the culture, like, if you don't realize that would have been sort of really unusual for someone to have a cell phone.
Now, if he had dropped his pager, you'd be like, ah, whatever.
Oh, my God. And today I would be like, a pager?
Right.
Are you a doctor?
Or a drug dealer. Those are the only people that have those.
You also had them on the crisis line.
Oh, really? You were, like, what if someone who, when you were off work, had called in with a crisis earlier, they could get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you would take a crisis shift and they would give you a pager and... it would kind of beep and you'd call the main center and they'd patch you together with whoever was calling.
Oh.
I think that's how a lot of those worked at that point. Yeah.
Interesting. Someday I'm going to have to hear all your tales I don't know. There's no patient confidentiality with that,
sure.
right? All right.
No, there is patient
confidentiality. Oh, there is? But I mean, like, you can't even talk about it? Ah! That's the one thing. Like, I can never know any of your stories, and I want to so bad. But I don't push because, you know, obviously that would not be cool. But I want to so bad.
That's kind of the whole thing of how it works.
I know. So, but if reality TV has taught me anything, people want their business out there.
Don't get me. I know. You made me watch L.A. Shrink.
I know, we can talk about that. Well, I need your professional opinion.
You don't go to the sex store and tell the clerk, I have a client coming in today and this is their issue. Okay?
No, that's not appropriate.
And then pose on the G-string display.
Oh my God, Dr. V. She's the best.
I'm not even asking.
Right, Sarah, this is the best shrink on this show.
She is, too!
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I watch crap TV. I admit it. I hide behind the fact that I have to do it for a job, for my job, but...
Oh, just not two ethics to rub together.
I know, it's terrible. Okay, so looking back, I mean... Here's the thing is, like, there's not really much we can say about the Scream franchise that hasn't been said a million times, but, I mean, just in terms of how it has, it even if you don't totally get on board with the films themselves, like, it definitely has had a major impact on the way horror films have been since then. I mean, there's been other movements like J-horror and torture porn and yada, yada, yada. But it definitely kicked off a whole craze at that point. Because then we got, like, Urban Legend, and I Know What You Did Last Summer. But even, it also has, there's still remnants of that in a lot of the stuff that you see today with, like, the super, like, clever dialogue with teens. Like, that's a trope that has sort of just, even while some of the slasher stuff may have fallen away, it's in TV, it's in movies, it's everywhere now. You know, it's become kind of the way that a lot of dialogue is just written now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not even so much this Scream and, like, the rebirth of slasher films as it, something about 90s TV for teens, because you had that kind of dialogue in My So-Called Life, you had it in Dawson's Creek, you had it, you know, and other shows that came out around that time that, you know, you had it in Buffy that were popular for people who, you know, and it wasn't like Growing Pains where it was like, gee, I don't know. I don't think I should break curfew, you know.
Growing Pains.
Yeah, I think that point in the 90s changed things.
Okay, that's fair enough. But I would say that the whole... fair enough. But what do you think about just being very self-aware? I feel like horror movies are much more self-aware. And, like, everyone kind of... The idea of them having rules has become more mainstream.
But, I mean, how many times do you complain about, like, zombie movies where it's like, okay, do you live in a universe where horror movies don't exist that you don't know that this shit... You know,
well, that's what I'm saying. It's like it's no longer acceptable to not know the rules of the movie that you're in to a certain degree, especially if it's something like a zombie movie where the rules are known.
Right.
You know, like I think people have less patience for the lack of like what you would call like horror movie logic where people are doing things that are uncharacteristic. And I think that has a direct link back to this idea that all of the characters know the horror movie tropes and that it follows a formula.
Yes? Yeah.
No? Yes?
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, I agree with you on that.
All right. Yes, I made a point. That feels like a win.
And do you think that's because of the Scream franchise or do you feel like that's because of, like Sarah was saying, like TV started going that way or there's something changing about the way that... I'm going to be the end of Scream 4 right now. I'm going to tell you this right now. like, is it something about how we kind of are self-aware and critical of our own experiences?
But I think that there's...
And have venues for talking about that?
But where did that start? You know what I mean? Like...
Well, technology is one.
Right. But I mean, even prior to like things like Facebook and MySpace, or not necessarily MySpace, but like Twitter and stuff like that, I'm talking about being self-aware of like horror movie rules.
Uh-huh.
Specifically.
But I think that like even early like internet communities where you could gather in one place and people who knew a lot about something could talk about it more easily. Right? That is yeah. kind of like in whatever live journal group or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I think that there's a way that we watch things differently now.
That's what I'm saying. But I think part of the seeds of that come from having overt conversations about the rules.
Yes.
Uh-huh. That came from this. I mean, I don't think this is, like, the sole cause. I mean, there's tons of reasons why that would be that horror movies have changed. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that there is a piece, that part of the legacy of the Scream movie is that kind of...
Is that for horror?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my opinion.
You would know that better than me. I would just think it's happening on a lot of different fronts.
Oh, right? Definitely.
Those same kind of conversations are happening on a lot of different fronts.
Right. I don't know. It's one of those things like art imitating life, imitating, you know what I mean? Like this movie came out prior to a lot of social networking. So yes, there were things like, you know, chat rooms and stuff like that, but it wasn't the same kind of ubiquitous level we're at now.
Uh-huh.
So even though I think that definitely played a role, this kind of maybe kickstarted some of that thinking.
Huh. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because I didn't see it at the time, I have no way to...
I mean, right. So that I must be right.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I remember, because I did see it at the time, it really felt like I never thought of that before, kind of. And it felt like maybe you sort of like subconsciously knew the rules, but you never overtly had thought about like, don't have sex. That was like, and the black character dies first. Like those were kind of the only real tropes that you know, everyone knew the rules. And so it was kind of interesting to see them discussed in that way and then applied the way they were applied to like every movie after that, mm-hmm. and especially during that era. And the way that they were played with, I think because it had been more self-aware, like people were trying to buck those ideas in sort of unique and creative tongue-in-cheek ways,
mm-hmm.
so that the rules have shifted as a result of having really examined them and made that a trope of a really popular franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm kind of coming up with this on the fly, so no. It could
we're
just
all
sound
tired.
Like
yeah.
No kidding. I know you're looking at the clock. You probably got to scram, huh?
Not too fast.
Okay, cool. So I feel like we covered Scream. What do you guys? You guys ready to move on?
Sure.
Okay. So should we talk about Netflix picks and anti-picks?
You know, I don't really have an anti-pick. Like I said, since the last podcast, I have just been swamped doing other things. And last night was the first time I'd actually been able to sit down and like watch a movie. So,
okay, that's fine. I got a pick. I just discovered it. Okay, so next time Sarah will tell you what to avoid. But this week I'm going to tell, or this week, this month I'm going to tell you what you should check out. So the Netflix pick for this episode is the film Acolytes from 2008, and here's the description. The very succinct subscription from Netflix. After finding a freshly buried body while learning the murderer's identity, three high schoolers elect to blackmail the culprit in this taut thriller. That really doesn't tell you much, but basically it takes place, I believe, in Australia. There's three teenagers. It's two guys and a girl, and they discover a teenage girl's body buried in a shallow grave in the woods. I think they may even, it's been a little while since I've seen this, but I think they may have even seen the guy burying her. Maybe not. Anyways, they have some trauma in their past that they're kind of trying to work out. And when they discover that there's, you know, a killer in their midst, they decide that they want to find him. They track him down, find him, and then blackmail him into getting revenge for them. And they see, like, he has a distinguishing kind of thing on his car, and it's a small little town in Australia. So they basically go neighborhood to neighborhood till they find him. The problem is it kind of backfires because this guy is not like, you know, this guy is not his first kill. He's not, you know, some, you know, pushover guy. Like, so he starts kind of stalking them back. And, it's actually pretty good. There's a lot of like, there's a kind of a teen drama vibe to it to a certain extent, but it's pretty gritty. And there's one especially brutal kill in it. And it's got some good plot twists, good acting. It's kind of grim. I really liked it. I give it a high recommendation. So check out Acolytes. I hope I didn't give too much away of the plot with that. Mm.
Sounds good.
Yeah. It is. I think you might actually like it. It's pretty good. So unless there's anything else you guys want to talk about, what's up for the next episode? Do we have any idea what we want to do? Or do something fun. We got to do something fun. Oh, Scream was fun. It was just a lot of movie. So I'm glad we did it, though. I actually did have a good time going back and revisiting these movies. So good job. So now that we're all good and fired up, should we talk a little bit about Walking Dead things out? Okay.
All right. Sarah, are you watching?
No, I stopped watching it.
What?
Last episode that I saw, Glenn and What's-Your-Face had gotten kidnapped.
That's where you stopped?
Glenn and Maggie.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see if you got stopped at the barn or the what is it, the country house with all the praying and the religiosity.
The farm and praying.
Oh,
I
couldn't handle. I stopped for like a long time. You were the one that talked me into going back.
It was only because it was a We Watch It Together show that I was not.
Because that religiosity was intense.
What are you talking about?
At the beginning of... Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about... Now that season three has ended, we're going to talk a little bit about Walking Dead. I mean, I don't know, Sarah, is it going to kill you if we spoil things? Or are you totally uninvested?
Really,
okay. Well, okay, so what I was saying, because you said you had fallen off, was that you had stopped at kind of an interesting point where the governor has taken Maggie and Glenn hostage and, like, you know, like, almost raping Maggie, and Glenn has his, like, battle with the zombie while tied to a chair, which was pretty badass, actually.
I love Glenn.
But yeah. For me, I actually stopped watching for a while. Matilda's one that sucked me back in, because at the first half of season two, after that awesome opening where the zombies are, like, the pack is coming through the cars and they're, like, hiding, which was fucking rad. And then they went to the farmhouse. And
it was just like feelings and God for
and
several
praying,
episodes.
So much praying.
And birth control misinformation.
Oh, that just about... Oh, my head almost fucking exploded. And I had heard that it was coming up. And so I was just like waiting for it. And then it was just as annoying as I thought it was going to be. Like, seriously? Walking Dead? Seriously? The morning after pill as an abortion pill? Really? And then she barfs
like
it up.
Months. Later.
Yeah, it's just like, oh my god. So yeah, I struggled with the first half of the second season. The second half of the season kicked in and redeemed it. I mean, obviously Lori is never redeemed, but at least it got better. It got really good at that second half. We dealt with the Shane issue. Thank God. I'm so sick of that love triangle. Uh-huh. I was hoping he would just take off with Andrea and we could, you know,
two birds with one stone.
Yes, because
I'm not so mad at Andrea.
How can you not hate Andrea? How can you watch someone make stupid decision after stupid decision?
You know what? Because there are so few people to like on this show.
That's true.
I am just desperate.
Right.
See, in the comic, Andrea was actually like
awesome,
badass.
She was a crack shot. She was a part of the core group from the jump. There was none of that, like, suicide boo-hoo-a-tree.
And what's his name with the RV? Like, she says flat out in the comics, she's like, you know, at first my sister and I flirted with him and kind of led him on to be able to stay with him through all of this. She goes, but honestly, I fell in love with him.
Yeah, her and Dale are together in the comics, which I was kind of glad they didn't go there, because I really did not want to see her and Dale hook up. It was not for me. Did not want. I mean, that's cool that you're down with it.
I'm down with it.
But I was not down with it at all.
I liked him,
I liked her with Shane. I thought her and Shane made sense. Ugh. I thought it might redeem both of their characters. No, never
Shane
done with
allergic.
Shane.
No,
yeah, I mean, Shane was a shitty character. I'm just, like you said, not, there's a real shortage of likable characters. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe that storyline could have gone some way to redeem him. Because he was, there were things about him prior to the apocalypse that, like, there were things about him, there was some humanity in him. And frankly, he wasn't really that wrong about how to live in the post-apocalypse right. world. Compared to Rick, who is the worst! I hate him!
I hate him.
I like the racist redneck more than I liked him. I mean, the only person I hate more is the governor. I mean, and actually, I don't even think I hate the governor more than
I don't hate
him.
The governor that much. Rick is to this show as, like, Nate was to Six Feet Under. Where he's supposed to be the everyman, and I just fucking hate him.
I hate him. He has absolutely no charm. Every decision he makes is wrong. He is a serial close talker, which is the kiss of death. I do not like a close talker. And he's just like, he's the worst. He's the worst. And that whole thing where he was, like, seeing his dead wife. And, ugh. And, like, going outside the fence and, like, leaving them unprotected. He's the worst. He is the worst. The only people
right,
on
but
there-
nobody's, like, kind of challenging him because, God forbid, we, like, challenge kind of pierce his masculinity at all.
Right. Ugh. The white sheriff man. And the other thing the show does that kills me is the like, rotating black character. There can, like, only be one black man on the show at any given time.
Is it like Glee, where there's, like, only one Shrug, and whoever is the fattest, they cover her arms?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, as soon as you see another black character, you're like, well, that person's no longer, you know, the one that you've been watching is dead in an episode or two.
Yeah.
As soon as they got to the prison and there was three black guys, you knew T-Dog was done. And then, as soon as you saw the next black character, like, every time, they just treat him out. And that is a problem they need to fix.
That is what I wanted to talk, why I wanted to talk to you, because, like, the racism on the show, it was so unbelievable around the question about saving Michonne.
Right?
Well, it is in the South.
I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't some, like, historical basis or accuracy to it, but we're talking about a fantasy series. I'd like to see a little more tact in dealing with diversity on the show.
I mean, if Herschel is, like, the, you know, Jesus-y...
Sorry, my pants are falling down.
...moral center, who I kind of dislike intensely, but whatever.
Randy loves Herschel.
Really?
Randy loves Herschel. I know. I don't care for Herschel either.
Just really.
Because that's when all the Jesus-y stuff was happening around
yeah,
that idiot.
He's just really sanctimonious. But, like now would be, then would be the time. They're talking about sacrificing Michonne. Right. Then would be the time
this is the
for
moment.
Sanctimonious ass Herschel to step in and be like, that's human, you know, we can't, what are we talking about doing with a human life? No one fucking says it.
I know. The only person that would have had
when
her back is Carl.
An African-American woman is on the line, then suddenly we
who
forget.
Who has saved their asses so many times. Who is clearly, like, the most capable in the group. She's a survivor who managed to survive on her own in the woods.
She's amazing. I know Andrew doesn't like her, which I
what?
Find interesting.
I love her.
He's
I love her.
He thinks this is... She's too two-dimensional, and I think
no.
her... I don't think so either. I kind of read
does he
it.
Think Lisbeth Salander is too two-dimensional? Because, I mean, she's the same kind of trauma
right.
kitty. Like, it's clear that whoever those
she's
zombies
very
were
wary.
Like... Uh-huh. Those... I mean, you get the impression that maybe they were, like... Because when she kills... Or she talks about them, she's like, you know, they were human, and she says they were never human. So you get the idea that maybe there was something...
Oh, yeah.
That happened with those people. Those are not, like, her friends that she had
no.
cruising around with no jaws and no arms. So, I mean, she clearly has plenty of reason to be kind of shut off emotionally, but...
And her, you know, her skills on that show are very, like, last girl horror skills, right?
Right.
About, like, trust no one.
I also feel like
don't
she's the most compassionate on the show while being, mm-hmm. even though she is outwardly very shut down, there that moment with Carl where she helps Carl get the picture, the fact that she saved and kept Andrea going, I mean, I think they were in
yeah,
love.
This is the other.
Right. Really? They couldn't have thrown us that bone. You know, like, we had to see her hook up with the governor, but they couldn't have thrown us, like, a little more of the... I mean, the person she clearly had the chemistry with. Although now, you know, Michonne's probably going to be a love interest for either Rick or Tyrese. That's going to happen.
She is in no, don't let it be Rick.
I know. I can't believe he survived. I wanted him to die so bad.
So irritating.
So bad. So, and then the governor got away and Rick's still alive. Did I mention Rick didn't fucking die? I wanted him to go so bad. Because I'm like, I'm ready for Michonne and Daryl to take over the group.
Yeah, but Rick's your lead guy.
It's not my lead guy.
Not my lead guy. It's kind of like Nate on 6 Feet Under. Like, I know this is supposed to be my stand-in.
No, thank you.
And no thanks.
Thanks, but no thanks. I do feel like they've killed off a lot of the people who were, like, extraneous and lame, like Lori dying. Although I was actually sad when Lori died. Not because I liked her, but just because that was such a brutal scene. Did you see that, Sarah?
Yeah, no, I saw when Lori died. And I mean, yeah, that was... Rough that was pretty stuff. Brutal, but at the same time, because I read the comic, I just kept waiting for her to die, and I was just like, okay, can she hurry up and fucking die now? I like the way it was done in the show. I like the way it was done better with the in the comic with because you know it's like the governor attacks the and his people attack the prison.
Mm-hmm.
The governor has a sharpshooter with him, and he has this woman take a shot at Lori, and she pierces Lori's heart or something like that, and ends up killing. What she doesn't see is that Lori was running with the baby, and so she ends up shooting both Lori and the baby, and
not a little ass kicker.
Yeah, and so she turns on the governor. And she's the one that kills the governor.
Interesting. You know?
Yeah.
So
That's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
So. I guess they didn't want to kill the baby on the show.
I bet they wouldn't on...
Plus, that's also kind of a character moment for Daryl, I think, right? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's the one that's, like, all about protecting the baby because Sophia died. Like, he's like, not another kid is going to die on my watch.
Mm-hmm.
Daryl's the
best. And see, for me, my biggest issue with The Walking Dead in general is that they take too long to get places. You know, just
because
like
in the comic, it's kind of like boom, boom, boom. Like they were in the you know, they were in the prison.
The governor is an issue. Okay,
right.
He's not an entire season.
Right.
And it's just it takes.
It's weird though. They softened him to begin with, and now they're like taking time to harden him. Like, by the end of the season, he's, like, totally a different character than when he gets there. In the comics, he is a monster from page one. Like,
yeah,
there's a part where they show, like, the rings where he's going to hold Michonne.
Mm-hmm.
In the comics, Michonne ends up in those rings. And he, like, beats her and rapes her and does all this fucked up stuff, right? And that's why Michonne is so hell-bent to kill him in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she has plenty of reason with the, you know... In the show, I actually kind of liked that. I'm glad we didn't go there. I didn't need to see Michonne get sexually assaulted. Really just didn't.
I would not.
Mm-mm. No, thank you. Like,
no, and it, I've,
there's
you know,
enough
that's,
implied
that's,
trauma
that's
there.
Fine. Yeah, I mean that's fine. You don't need to have that kind of brutality out. It's just, yeah, he was a twisted bastard in the comic, and he
he's getting there on the show. He's not there yet.
Like he appears on the show, and he's like, you know, he's just like, hey, Smithers. Welcome to Woodsbury. Can I get you something to drink? Do you need clothes? And you're just like, really? This guy? And it's just like, I lost interest. I kind of
liked it in the way that I like that the twist in 28 Days Later, where they finally get to the military base, and turns out that they're just like chomping at the bit to get the ladies, but there's like that false sense of security that you know something is off. I liked that they played with that a little bit. It wasn't quite so heavy-handed as in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
But I do get what you're saying.
Did he have a Smithers in the comic like he does on the show?
I don't. It's been so long since I read the comic. Oh, she was asking if he has a Smithers.
His
I don't remember
assistant.
A Smithers.
No, he's got more of a. Well, yeah, he does because he does have somebody working on trying to find a cure.
I don't remember.
But
that at all.
If
so
I remember
funny.
Correctly, and like I said, it's been a while since I read the comic, so I know he's got like the Merle type enforcer character because they actually gang up on Michonne.
Yeah.
but
tired of characters being shaped by rape.
I want to say,
I'm like, that is such a trope I'd like to see go away.
I want to say that yes he does, and that's the character that tells Rick that he's got a radio and that he's been in touch with the Pentagon and the CDC, and he's this, you know, world-renowned scientist that he needs to get over to the CDC because he has important work to do. They're close to finding a cure, and then come to find out that this guy's radio died like months ago, and he's like a janitor in a lab, and it's all bullshit. And you know, this is right. Like after they leave.
Instead of having the CDC first, like they did in the show.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. What did you think about this season? I mean, I felt like season two was like crap, 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 awesome. Whereas this one was sort of like awesome, crap, awesome, crap, awesome, crap.
Yeah, this one was such a mixed bag. Like even the return of Merle was such a mixed bag. Although right. The end of that was deeply satisfying to me. Yeah.
Well, I like that he got a little redeemed in the end, but in a very Merle way. Mm-hmm. Like he's still doing the wrong thing, but for the right reason, for like the first time ever, that added a little
with
bit
Motorhead.
Of weight. I know. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Of course he's listening to Motorhead. But, and that
it was just, I felt like Daryl has needed to do that for a very, very, very long time.
Right.
Yeah.
But I did like that we got a little bit of the interaction of the brothers because it kind of peeled back a few layers on Daryl. I mean,
right. And the trauma stuff with them. Yeah.
Like that you saw his scars on his back and you see Merle be like, whoa. And you kind of understand that dynamic a little bit, that Merle was abused and took off.
Mm-hmm.
And that it thinking, never considering that it would just get passed down to Daryl. So there's like this kind of unspoken resentment there that it's like complex because it's like his brother and there's like, he loves his older brother and admires his older brother. He did. Until he got into this first time we ever was in a family dynamic.
I really liked that, and I thought they did it subtly and well and realistically, as opposed to if that had happened in season two.
Oh, it would have been like a whole episode.
Sat around on the steps of churches thinking about it for fucking hours.
So true. So sadly true. But I did think Merle needed to come back. We needed some closure with that character.
Uh-huh.
And then in the, I also
would have liked to see him
really,
go quicker.
But I loved the scene with him and Michonne in the car where you're kind of getting a glimpse behind both of their curtains.
Yeah.
And that they're both these outsiders and the way that their survival in like is different and how she's embracing community and he's like embracing the outsider thing to the point where he's like, self-destructive and doesn't even know why he's like, he can't, it's just who he is, like there's no hope for this character, and so this is sort of his last hurrah
to make some kind of a different choice.
Yeah, but he does it in a fucked up way.
Yeah,
where he shoots like a teenager
a
in the face,
but not
and
a lot, like he would he,
no no
so
I mean
much that he would
you
have
can't
to
he's like a racist piece of sexist rapey piece of shit.
Yeah,
but at the same time, you know, it humanized him a little bit in a way. And he's Michael Rooker. You can't hate Michael Rooker. All right, I'm gonna excuse his behavior.
It's not gonna be like
Schillinger. I am an apologist. I am a Rooker apologist.
It's not gonna be like Schillinger in Oz that every time you see him in anything else.
Well, I mean,
like,
he'll always be Henry, A Portrait of a Serial Killer, but he's Michael Rooker. He's got the voice, and I don't know. I just like him. I do. I just like him. which is terrible. Which, what does that say about me? That I'm like, yay, Henry. But I do. I like that actor a lot. He has that kind of like rough graveliness to him that I don't know. I like him. I don't know why. I can't explain it. But and then the Daryl thing
was
so.
I thought I was gonna die when Michonne was. They weren't even talking about saving Michonne, and the you know, and just kind of like the political implications of like the only thing that saves her is that she took good care of a white kid.
Oh my God, I never even thought about that. You're so fucking right. Do you still hate Carl?
The kid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Carl.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
I know you're like, he is the scariest character on there.
And I like creepy kid movies, but he's the creepiest fucking kid. He's a little sociopath. I don't like him
at all. I think the setup for that story in season 4 is going to be good. Sorry, Sarah, go ahead. We're totally talking
gonna say,
over you.
I was going to say in the comic, he does some things that, like, they have, there's some kids that have been bit and they're taking them along, and Carl is the one that kills them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a part where Rick and Carl gets separated from the rest of the group. This is after the thing with the governor, and they try to and they come across a group of men who try and rape Carl, and Rick ends up killing them all, and it's just like after that, like Carl's just kind of snaps, like he's just very cold and very, you know, to business.
I like that they did not go that route. Yeah. Like it's enough that he's a child who's growing up in this era, and the way that that is shaping him, plus the death of his mother, like that is enough trauma.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? I don't need all, that's so like heavy handed, like thud.
I mean, I guess I can kind of appreciate that this is like the rules of the zombieverse as translated into the ethics of a little kid. Right, like a little kid is not going to understand a lot of complexity about that.
Right. Well, I also think we ended the season with Rick showing up with a pack more of people. And you can just see Carl look on Carl's face like, really? More mouths to feed? Like, can you make a hard choice, Dad? Because he is the hard choice kid. He's watched people doing the humane thing so many times backfire that when he's presented with that thing where the kid has a gun and he may or may not be dropping the gun, he just shoots.
But he has Daryl, like he has role models that are able to make more complex choices.
Right.
He doesn't just have jackass old Rick.
Right. I think it's not that he's looking to him as a role model so much as looking to him as a failed role model.
Yeah.
He's not interested in following in his footsteps at all. But he also is the only one that is smart enough to see the value in Michonne.
Yeah.
Everybody else is on the fence with her because she's quiet and black. Let's say it.
Not girly.
Yeah. She's not going to go up there and, you know, nurse little ass kicker and wash the clothes. Like, she's... And Andrea was ostracized because she wanted to be with the men, and now Michonne... You're right. There is something about, like, breaking that gender role that makes her...
Mm-hmm. She's non-domestic sphere.
Yeah, makes her disposable to a certain degree. Where the fact is, she's incredibly valuable. Not more valuable, because women's work is just... quote-unquote women's work is just as valuable. But you know what I mean? In that world, you need warriors, and she's a warrior. It has nothing to do with gender, but
it's her empathic labor as on a white kid that saves her, that just kind of kills me.
I hadn't even gone there with it. It was more just like I saw them as two broken people, but you're right. I mean, there is that aspect, and it took a very
sweet scene between them and kind of made it gross for me.
Right. That was a good scene, though.
Yeah, and she's like, I just couldn't live without this cat statue or whatever.
That was funny.
That was great.
And that's what I'm saying. I'm liking that we're getting peaks of her true character, and I think she's going to be awesome next season. I hope so. Although, fuck, she's probably forced back into her shell by having to watch Andrea shoot herself in the head. Sorry, spoiler alert.
It's all right. I've been reading, like, episode updates, but, yeah, like I said, I just feel like... I'm going to wait till it comes out on DVD. That way I can just fast forward through all the boring shit. No, I hope for season 4 that they at least come across the cannibal people.
Oh.
Because
hold on.
That's how Dale dies in the comic is they hold up in a church. And Dale had wandered off to take a leak and never comes back. And it turns out he gets kidnapped by these people. Well, the group had figured he'd wandered off to take a leak, and they find him, and he's missing both his legs because
this
has amputated his legs so they can eat.
Wow.
See, I'm into that. I'm into the whole road aspect of it. Did you ever read that book or watch that movie?
Oh, yeah, I read the book.
I didn't, but you know what? One of my favorite books is a very similar theme, which is the Parable of the Sower or Parable of the Talents. Have you read those?
Are those the
Octavia Butler?
Yeah.
No, they're not Margaret Atwood.
Okay.
They're Octavia Butler, who's a science fiction writer, but they're near future.
Mm-hmm.
They're like The Road. The Road came out after these.
That was a rough go.
You would like these. This is girl, they're written in the 90s. Girl, teenager, camouflaging as male for survival
reasons.
That
sounds like my jam.
And the United States has become a theocracy.
Oh, yeah, I'm in. You got me.
And it's very, and the second one, The Parable of the Talents, was written during the second, the George W. Bush era. And so it's like an evangelical theocracy.
Ugh, that is my worst nightmare.
You will like it.
What I was saying about Daryl, though, is like this, in order to flush the rest of the group out, they put Daryl out in the middle of the lawn and they start sniping anyone who tries to get to him. So long story short, what you find out is that the reason why Dale had wandered off wasn't to go take the leak. It was because they had fought off a couple of zombies before and he got bit. And even though it's just it was a small bite, and so you come to find out these people have eaten tainted meat.
So does that zombify them?
Well, the comic breaks away from the group. Like, they manage to rescue Dale, and then they end up having to put him down, and Andrea is the one that puts him down,
of course, because that would be the most tragic way.
Yeah.
They're like, how can we make this as rough as possible? Okay, well, that is it for episode 28. Thank you, ladies, for joining me and talking about Scream and The Walking Dead and a million other subjects. And thank you, everyone out there, for listening. You know, we love to hear from you. So definitely drop us a line at rachel@zombiegirls.com. Or if you feel so inclined, we also love it if you leave us a review on iTunes. All right. Thanks for listening. Bye.
I was not a fan of cats.
By the way, side note, here goes my cat trying to hump a fucking Snuggie.
Oh, I get to see it.
This is what let's see if he makes the noise. Oh yeah. Here we go. Lining it up. Really, Lister?
Really?
In front of company? Yeah. Good times.
Wow. Look at that. Look, oh, sorry, Lester.
Look at his face. He's like, am I going to be told to stop? Because he knows it's coming any second now. He's not doing the noise. Usually there's a lot of caterwauling. All right, Lister, come on. Lister, enough. Enough. Come on. Lister, enough. Come on. Yes, stop humping. That's what I'm saying.
No, I did really like... Yeah?
It was like somebody... Lister, stop. My cats are acting like crazy tonight. Please stop chewing on everything. I know you're sexually frustrated because I cut you off from humping that Snuggie, but come on, dude.
Come here, Lester.
Hold on. I gotta note this so I can cut it out later. Save this for the outtakes. My cat humping.
Any port in a storm.
No kidding. Any Snuggie in a storm. Lester. That's his... I swear to God, I think my cat is a sex addict because every single night, as soon as I put up the baby gates and go to sleep and he knows I can't just like run out and stop him, I hear him humping away. And the thing is, you look at him, he's got these big, innocent eyeballs. Like, I would never sexually molest your...
I know, he's my cat boyfriend over here. Lister, do you want to smell my linens? Shoe? I know you like that.
He does like that. He's also got a foot fetish. My cat is a freak. What are you going to do? All right, hold on.
I have a cat that will... She's the inappropriate licker. Like, she'll come up and stick her, like... tongue up your nose or eyeball or they'll be asleep and you get this tongue in your ear. You're like, ah.
Inappropriate looker. Oh, cats are the best. Oh my God. Lister! Stop. For realsies. That's my Kardashian collection dress.
Did they spell dress with a K?
They would if they could. It's like, dress, the K is silent. Okay, so... oh my god, I'm so tired. Oh my god. Lister! Get away from that! Alright, hold on. I gotta go move it. I'll be right back. Sorry, totally gave you butt crack.
I took it to the knitting convention a couple months ago. It was a train full of knitters.
That was
who are really
intense.
More intense and angry people than you might expect.
Really?
A little bit.
Yeah. Knitters, man, they are some just wacky people.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that yarn market was fucking Thunderdome.
They get mean. Dude, they get mean.
Yeah.
I had like, no
I'm,
idea.
I'm surprised like nobody's got like knitting needle puncture wounds.
Yeah.
I see a horror movie franchise.
Well, the old aluminum ones aren't in use very much anymore.
Well, I mean, like, I've seen Guinea Pig. I've seen Sallow. Sallow just kind of, it was kind of like, eh.
Isn't that more like pooey, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, I said Two Girls, One Cup, and was just like, all right, maybe I'll skip the dip cone at Wiener Schnitzel tonight, you know? that was pretty much my only take on it. It just...
That's so gross. Mm-hmm. Someone totally tricked me into seeing that. They're like, hey, check out this video we did. And then next thing I know, it's like, butthole. I was like, no! unsee.
Poo isn't that upsetting to me.
People eating poo?
Whatever.
Eternal sunshine. I guess. I don't know. It's gross. I don't care. You can think I'm repressed. Eating poo
No,
is
I don't
gross.
Think you're repressed.
I'm standing behind my anti-poo.
Right. Evolved people like it, right?
Hello, outtake. No. Poo is not for eating. It's not!
No, that's the outtake.
It's not. I feel confident in that stance. The poo is not for eating. I like it.